After he had journeyed, and his feet were sore, and he was tired, he came upon an orange grove, and he rested. And he lay in the cool, and while he rested, he took to himself an orange and tasted it. And it was good. And he felt the earth to his spine, and he asked. And he saw the tree above him, and the stars, and the veins in the leaf, and the light, and the balance. And he saw magnificent perfection, whereon he thought of himself in balance, and he knew he was. And he thought of those he angered, for he was not a violent man. And he thought of those he hurt, for he was not a cruel man. And he thought of those he frightened, for he was not an evil man. And he understood. He understood himself. On this, he saw that when he was of anger, or knew hurt, or felt fear, it was because he was not understanding. And he learned compassion. And with his eye of compassion, he saw his enemies, like unto himself. And he learned love. Then he was answered.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, August 5th, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389#. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions, that's questions plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please find our business partners, support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Tonight's scripture reading, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. We'll be looking at Mark chapter 1. Gospel of Mark chapter 1, verses 29 through 45. And forthwith, when they were come out of the synagogue, they entered into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. But Simon's wife's mother lay sick of a fever, and anon they tell him of her. And he came and looked and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and immediately the fever left her, and she ministered unto them. And at evening, when the sun had did set, they brought unto him all that were diseased and them that were possessed with devils, and all the city was gathered together at the door. and he healed many that were sick of divers of various diseases, and cast out many devils, and suffered not the devils to speak, because they knew him. And in the morning, rising up a great while before day, he went out and departed into a solitary place, and there prayed. And Simon and they that were with him followed after him. And when they had found him, they said unto him, All men seek for thee. And he said unto them, Let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also, for therefore came I forth. And he preached in their synagogues throughout all Galilee, and cast out devils. And there came a leper of him, beseeching him, and kneeling down to him, and saying unto him, If thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And Jesus, moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him, and said unto him, I will, be thou clean. And as soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy departed from him, and he was cleansed. And he straitly charged him, and forthwith sent him away, and said unto him, See thou say nothing to any man, but go thy way, show thyself to the priest, and offer for thy cleansing those things which Moses commanded for a testimony unto them. But he went out and began to publish it much, and to blaze abroad the matter, insomuch that Jesus could no more openly enter into the city, but was without in desert places. And there came to him from every quarters. Gospel of Mark, chapter 1. Verses 29 through 45. Okay, if anybody would like to get into the queue, star 6 and then a 1. Star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Tonight's topic we're going to take a look at, and again, we've shortened our time for our topics, so we try to keep them down 20, 25 minutes or so. But in any event, each one of these topics is extremely important. We choose them for a reason. Of course, it expands your understanding of what's really going on, what's going happening in the court system, and maybe how the court system works, what the law is, and the difference between equity and law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so tonight's topic, jury tampering and stacking. If anybody would like to follow along, you can find a copy of the memorandum that we're going to be reading. And you'll find it up at nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on grand jury, highlight grand jury, and come down and click on action against the judiciary. Come down more than halfway, and you'll see memorandums of law. And you click on the memorandum for jury tampering and stacking. And you can follow along on that paper as we go forward. So again, topic, memorandum of law, jury tampering and stacking. Memorandum of law, jury tampering and stacking. The purpose of this memorandum is to reestablish the true authority of the people via the jury. The grand and petty juries are one of the most powerful ways that we, the people, consent to government's actions against the people. The people, via the untainted grand jury, are to decide whether government accusations are warranted. And the people, via the untainted petit juries, are to decide fact and law, guilt or innocence, and a proper sentences that will fulfill the remedy for the injured party. It is the people's unalienable right to have access to the grand jury. The grand jury is the sureties of the peace between the government and the people. The grand jury has the authority to settle matters without going to trial if they can find common agreement between the accused and the accuser. Prosecutors do not. Sheriffs and coroners are to have unbridled access to the grand jury without going through a prosecutor who thinks they have the authority to veto the charges or deny said access. The people ought to have unlimited access to the grand jury. The grand jury has the unbridled authority to investigate any matter brought before them. The bar judiciary has robbed the people's sovereign right to consent, judge, and investigate. They have written handbooks and questionnaires designed to control and stack the juries to get their political indictments and convictions. And they have isolated the juries to a degree that not even the sheriff can gain access without a bar monitor. After indictments are founded, prosecutors think that they have the authority to make a plea deal. They don't. Prosecutors think they have the authority to add or remove charges made by the grand jury. They don't. Likewise, judges think they can order the Pettit jury to enforce codes as law. They don't. Judges think that they can declare a mistrial if the jury is divided or even throw out the jury's decision and retry. They don't. Federal trial handbook tampers with the jury and robs the people's sovereign right to judge. The federal trial handbook is an effort to taint and control the jury and repeats 12 times that the judge is beside the law and not the jury. Joseph Goebbels, Adolf Hitler's propaganda minister, said, "If you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it, and you will even come to believe it yourself." Vladimir Lenin, the Russian communist revolutionary, said, "A lie told often enough becomes the truth." On page 1, we read, "The judge determines the law to be applied in the case, while the jury decides the facts." On page 3, we read, "The judge in a criminal case tells the jury what the law is. The jury must determine what the true facts are. On that basis, the jury has only to determine whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty of each offense charged. The subsequent sentencing is the sole responsibility of the judge. In other words, in arriving at an impartial verdict as a guilt or an innocent of a jury defendant, the jury is not to consider the sentence." On page 8, we read, "The law is what the presiding judge declares the law to be, not what a jury believes it to be, or what a jury may have heard it to be from any source other than the presiding judge." On page 9, we read, "It is the jury's duty to reach its own conclusion based on the evidence. The verdict is reached without regard to what may be the opinion of the judge as to the facts may be, although as to the law, the judge's charge controls." On page 9, we read, "In both civil and criminal cases, it is the jury's duty to decide the facts in accordance with the principles of the law laid down in the judge's charge to the jury. The decision is made on the evidence introduced, and the jury's decision on the facts is usually final." On page 10, we read, "Jurors should give close attention to the testimony. They are sworn to disregard their prejudices and follow the court's instructions. They must render a verdict according to their best judgment." On page 10 again, we read, "A juror should also disregard any statement by a lawyer as to the law of a case. It is not in accord with the judge's instruction." Finally, on page 12, we read, "The Sixth Amendment's guarantee of a trial by an impartial jury requires that a jury's verdict must be based on nothing else but the evidence and the law presented to them in court. The words of the Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes from over a century ago applied with equal force to jurors serving in this advanced technology age. The theory of our system is that the conclusion to be reached in a case will induce only by evidence and argument to open court, and not by any outside influence, whether of private talk or public print." What the author left out was that Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes also said, in the same place, "The jury has the power to bring a verdict in the teeth of both the law and the facts." In conclusion, the Federal Trial Handbook wars against we the people's unalienable right as the source and author of the law of the land in an attempt to subvert we the people's unalienable right of government by consent. None of our founding fathers or supporters of the law of the land, also known as the common law, denied the unalienable rights of we the people's right of nullification. The criminal patent jury instructions developed by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit for use by U.S. District Courts state, You as jurors are judge of the facts, but in determining what actually happened, that is in reaching your decision as to the facts. It is your sworn duty to follow all the rules of the law as I explain them to you. You have no right to disregard or give special attention to any one instruction or to question the wisdom or correctness of any rule I may state to you. You must not submit or follow your notions or opinions as to what the law is or ought to be. It is your duty to apply the law as I explain it to you, regardless of the consequences. However, you should not read into these instructions or anything else I may have said or done any suggestions as to what your verdict should be. That is entirely up to you. It is also your duty to base your verdict solely upon the evidence without prejudice or sympathy. That was the promise you made and the oath you took. This is a lie. Handbook for Federal Grand Jurors: Subvert the Author and Source of Law. We the People. Number 1. The Federal Grand Jury Handbook, which was written by bar judges, make the following 11 foundational false claims, thereby creating a statutory grand jury under government control and not under the control of the people, thus rendering use of these indictments a nullity. Number 2. The jury derives its authority from the Constitution, legislated statutes, and the court's rules. False. The first grand jury consisted of 12 men who were summoned. False. Grand jurors originally functioned as accuser or witness rather than as judges. False. The grand jury hears only that evidence presented by the United States attorney. False. A grand jury is not necessary for prison sentencing less than 1 year. False. A person may waive grand jury proceedings and agree to be prosecuted. False. The grand jury is not free to compel a trial of anyone it chooses. False. The government attorney must sign the indictment before the party may be prosecuted. False. The grand jury is to consult the government before undertaking a formal investigation. False. The grand jury cannot investigate without government approval. False. The grand jury is composed of 23 government-qualified persons. False. Rebuttal to the false claims of the handbook for federal grand jurors and proof positive of its deceptiveness. Number 1. Handbook falsely claims the federal grand jury derives its authority from the rules of the federal courts. See page 1, Handbook for Federal Grand Juries. Rebuttal. The jury is an unalienable right derived from God and the process by which we have government by consent of the people. Quoting United States versus Williams, because the grand jury is an institution separate from the court, over whose functioning the courts do not preside, we think it clear that, as a general matter at least, no such supervisory judicial authority exists, and that the disclosure rule applied here exceeded the Tenth Circuit's authority. Rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, in Hanna versus Losh, we read the grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, but not in the body of the Constitution. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches thereof in the first three articles. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right. In fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch of the institutional government, serving as a kind of buffer or referee between the government and the people. In Miranda versus Arizona, we read, where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Number 2. Handbook falsely claims the first English grand jury consisted of 12 men from the knights or other freemen who were summoned to inquire into crimes alleged to have been committed in the local community. See page 1, Handbook for the Federal Grand Jury. Rebuttal. Magna Carta, paragraph 52, said that the first known grand jury organized themselves and acted under the authority of the sovereign people and is made up of 25 jurors, of whom mention is made below in the clause for securing the peace. 3. Handbook falsely claims. Grand juries originally functioned as accuser or witness rather than as judges. See page 2, Handbook for Federal Grand Jurors. Rebuttal. Magna Carta being the forerunner to our Declaration of Independence is the people being the consenters and putting down the tyrants and the first and foremost settlers of wrongdoing. Paragraph 52 says that the grand jury is the sureties of the peace, whereas we read, if anyone has been dispossessed without the legal judgment of his peers from his lands, castles, franchises, or from his right, we will immediately restore them to him. And if a dispute arises over this, then let it be decided by the 25 jurors of whom mentioned is made below in the clause for sentencing the peace. Moreover, for all those possessions from which anyone has, without the lawful judgment of his peers, been deceased or removed by our government, we will immediately grant full justice therein. Number 4. Handbook falsely claims. The grand jury normally hears only that evidence presented by a United States attorney. See page 3, Handbook for Federal Grand Jurors. Rebuttal. Again, the aforesaid would deny government by consent and place we the people in subjection to our servant prosecutors. Quoting United States versus Williams, the grand jury's functional independence from the judicial branch is evident both in the scope of its power to investigate criminal wrongdoing and in the manner in which that power is exercised. Unlike a court, whose jurisdiction is predicated upon a specific case or controversy, the grand jury can investigate merely on suspicion that the law is being violated, or even because it wants assurance that it is not. It need not identify the offender, its suspects, or even the precise nature of the offense it is investigating. Number 5. Handbook falsely claims. An infamous crime is one which may be punished by imprisonment for more than 1 year. This infers that an indictment is not necessary for legislated sentencing of crimes calling for less than a year's imprisonment. See page 3, Handbook for the Federal Grand Jurors. Rebuttal. The unalienable right of a grand jury is a part of due process of law and cannot be denied if the unalienable right of a liberty hangs in the balance. Amendment 5, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on the presentment or indictment of a grand jury, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. An infamous crime is one that might require a prison sentence. 6. Handbook falsely claims. The persons being investigated by the government may, however, waive grand jury proceedings and agree to be prosecuted by written charges of a crime called an information. See page 4, Handbook for Federal Grand Jurors. Rebuttal. The Fifth Amendment denied the aforesaid conclusion, and we the people say no person shall be held to answer. Therefore, an information from a prosecutor in place of a grand jury indictment is repugnant and void, for it too easily opens the door of abuse under color of law and extortion and vindictive prosecutions. 7. Handbook falsely claims. The grand jury is not completely free to compel a trial of anyone it chooses. And number 8. Handbook falsely claims the government attorneys must sign the indictment before a party may be prosecuted. Thus, the government and the grand jury act as checks on each other. This assures that neither may arbitrarily wield the awesome power to indict a person of a crime. See page 4, Handbook for Federal Grand Jurors. Rebuttal for 7 and 8. The aforesaid would deny government by consent and place we the people in subjection to our servant prosecutors. Quoting again, U.S. versus William, the grand jury requires no authorization from its constitutional court to initiate an investigation. Nor does the prosecutor require leave of the court to seek grand jury indictment. And in its day-to-day functioning, the grand jury generally operates without the interference of a presiding judge. It swears in its own witnesses and deliberates in total secrecy. The grand jury remains free to pursue its investigations unhindered by external influence or supervision, so long as it does not trench upon the legitimate right of any witness called before it. There is yet another respect in which respondents' proposals not only fails to comport with, but positively contradicts the common law of the Fifth Amendment grand jury. Motions to quash indictments based upon the sufficiency of the evidence relied upon by the grand jury were unheard of at common law in England. And the traditional American practice was described by Justice Nelson, writing circuit in 1852, as follows. No case has been cited, nor have we been able to find any, furnishing an authority for looking into the revising the judgment of a grand jury upon the evidence, for the purpose of determining whether or not the finding was founded upon sufficient proof or whether there was a deficiency in respect to any part of the complaint. We accepted Justice Nelson's description, where we held that it would run counter to the whole history of the grand jury's institution to permit an indictment to be challenged on the grounds that there was incompetent or inadequate evidence before the grand jury. And we reaffirmed this principle recently in Bank of Nova Scotia, where we held that the mere fact that evidence itself is unreliable is not sufficient to require a dismissal of the indictment, and that a challenge to the reliability of or competence of the evidence presented to the grand jury will not be heard. It would make little sense, we think, to abstain from reviewing the evidentiary support for the grand jury's judgment while scrutinizing the sufficiency of the prosecutor's presentation. A complaint about the quality or adequacy of evidence can always be recast as a complaint that the prosecutor's presentation was incomplete or misleading. Our words in Castella bearing repeating, review of facially valid indictments on such grounds would run counter to the whole history of the grand jury institution, and neither justice nor the concept of a fair trial requires. Number 9, Handbook falsely claims the grand jury may consider additional matters otherwise brought to its attention, but should consult with the government attorney or the court before undertaking a formal investigation of such matters. This is necessary because the grand jury has no investigative staff, and legal assistance will be necessary in the event of an indictment is voted. See page 5, Handbook for the Federal Grand Jurors. Rebuttal. Again, the aforesaid would deny government by consent and place we the people in subjection to our servant prosecutors. Recognizing this tradition of independence, we have said that the Fifth Amendment's Constitution's guarantee presupposes an investigative body acting independently of either prosecuting attorney or judge. Again, the United States versus Williams. Number 10, Handbook falsely claims a federal grand jury is not authorized to investigate situations involving the conduct of individuals, public offices, agencies, or institutions. See page 5, again for the Handbook for Federal Grand Jury. Rebuttal. The aforesaid would place the government above reproach, whereby they could prevent indictments against their own, and again, would deny government by consent and place we the people in subjection to our servant prosecutors. Quoting again, United States versus Williams, giving the grand jury operational separateness from its constituting court, it should come as no surprise that we have been reluctant to invoke judicial supervisory powers as a basis for prescribing modes of grand jury procedure. Over the years, we have received many requests to exercise supervision over the grand jury's evidence-taking process, but we have refused them all, including some more appealing than the one present today. In Calandra versus the United States, a grand jury witness faced questions that were allegedly based upon physical evidence the government had obtained through a violation of the Fourth Amendment. We rejected the proposal that exclusory rule be extended to grand jury proceedings because of the potential injury to the historic role and function of the grand jury. We declined to enforce the hearsay rule in grand jury proceedings, since that would run counter to the whole history of the grand jury institution, in which laymen conduct their inquiries unfettered by technical rules. Furthermore, this is precisely why non-political and non-governmental employed people educated in real American history, the Constitution, natural law, and the court process need to be without bias, interference, and control in the administration and in the administrating to both the grand and the petit jury, as opposed to the politically and bar-controlled judges and prosecutors who have seized control of the jury process in order to maintain the status quo and prevent their crimes from being investigated. Number 11, Handbook falsely claims. The judge will then direct the selected 23 qualified persons to become the members of the grand jury. See page 6, again, in the handbook for the federal grand jurors. Rebuttal. Magna Carta, paragraph 52, makes it clear that a grand jury is made up of 25 people, not 23, and states, if a dispute arises over this, then let it be decided by the 5 and 20 jurors of whom mention is made below in the clause for securing the peace. Furthermore, a qualified person is any peer that cannot be shown as biased. The court does not have the authority to perform a psych evaluation on the jurist via questionnaire. Federalist jurist questionnaires profiles and provide for jury stacking. The federal questionnaire for jurist, when asked many inappropriate questions, becomes a tool of a trial judge and prosecutor to profile and stack the jury for favorable result to maintain the status quo for political favors. Some of the questions we have found on these questionnaires are as follows. Dates of birth, work and marital status of the potential juror and all members of the juror's household, sex, age, and employment of children who do not reside with them, who do not reside with the juror. Education, knowledge of law, principal leisure time, activities, civic, social, political, or professional organizations to which the juror belongs. List of television and or radio or news programs, newspapers, magazines that the juror receives their propaganda from. In addition, did the jurors or members of their family ever own a gun or belong to any kind of an anti-gun or pro-gun club or organization or military service? Have jurors' family members or friends ever been audited by or had a dispute with any agency of the Department of the United States government, including the IRS, Social Security Administration, Veterans Administrations, etc., or any city or state government agency? Finally, the most revolting question, which is couched in such a way that is to lead the potential jury to conclude that the question is directly from the judge. Do you have any idea or prejudice that would hinder you from following the instructions that I, the judge, will give as to the law? As Lysander Spooner, author of Trial by Jury, 1852, so clearly pointed out, governments cannot decide the law or exercise authority over jurors, the people, for such would be absolute government, absolute despotism, which is where we're at. Such is our condition today, and we, the people, are determined to end it here, today, at this crossroad. Right of grand and petit jurors. Lysander Spooner, an essay on Trial by Jury, 1852. There can be no legal right to resist the oppressions of the government unless there be some legal tribunal other than the government and wholly independent of and above the government to judge between the government and those who resist its oppressions. The authority to judge what are the powers of the government and what are the liberties of the people must necessarily be vested in one or the other of the parties themselves, the government or the people, because there is no third party to whom it can be entrusted. If the authority be vested in the government is absolute, and the people have no liberties except such as the government sees fit to indulge them with. The grand jury is an investigative body acting independently of either prosecutor or judge, whose mission is to bring to trial those who may be guilty and clear the innocents. Although the grand jury normally operates, of course, in the courthouse and under the judicial auspices, its institutional relationship with the judicial branch has traditionally been, so to speak, at arm's length. Conclusion. We, the people, have the unalienable right to consent or not to consent. And as to the government's accusations against the people, the handbook for the federal grand jury and trial juries are subversive and is 100% proof of jury tampering, and thereby shows the need for free and independent grand and petit jury administrators. All officers of the court, judges, prosecutors, appointed counsels, attorneys, sheriffs, marshals, and clerks, law enforcement agencies, U.S. marshals, and legislators of statute are employed by the government and or are members of the bar, which teaches their members to be anti-constitutional and anti-common law, and thereby subversive by simply maintaining their ignorance in the Constitution and the common law, as they are trained to place the letter of the law above the essence of common law, that being justice and mercy. Allowing our servants to control the jury has bred absolute government corruption and control over this paper and the memorandum of jury nullification, and present jury conditions conclusively proves. Therefore, it is the unalienable right of we the people to provide for the administration of the grand and petit juries. The first recorded grand jury was established by the people through the Magna Carta, whereas the grand jury assembled itself and brought into subjection the tyrant king back under the will of the people. And today, now, herein, so do we, the people. Dated, sealed, grand jury foreman. Okay, we're going to open up in a short while. Again, anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6, and then a 1 to get into the queue. I want to make one big announcement. Pretty much finished the papers for filing on the court against the United States Supreme Court and against the Congress, both houses. We're working through now to have them perfected. We're hoping by Thursday we got a small committee put together to go through the papers, give some thoughts, ideas, corrections, and maybe things to add or whatever, and also correct the punctuation, English, and so on. And we hope to have that done by the end of the day Thursday. That being the case, it'll give me a weekend to prepare all the papers and get things together. And our target date of filing this is going to be Monday, which I think is the 12th. Let me take a quick look. Yeah, it'll be the 12th Monday. Now, that's not etched in stone. It could take a little longer than the weekend to prepare everything, or we may just feel like we want to wait a couple of more days. We're kind of falling right in the timing of what's going on in Washington. A lot of things are going to be released mid-August or around the week of the 12th. I saw some big item things that was released today concerning the FBI, where it was released that during the process of going after Trump, they had destroyed, some computer hard drives, cell phones smashed with hammers, and acid washed, I guess, certain programs. Like, I don't know that they do that online. I'm sure they do that in the computers on the hard drive, but I don't know what they can do online or whatever. But in any event, that kind of thing was released today, and it's pretty damning. It really lays out subversion, no doubt, and that they were trying to overthrow the president of the United States. In any event, what we are doing is really directly sort of connected to what they're doing out there in Washington as far as the timing is concerned. Because once things hit the fan, so to speak, and our papers hit at the right time, they're going to be thinking about how they're going to be protected. They're going to lose their protection. And so maintaining the status quo by some of these judges might have a change of heart. Now, the papers we wrote is, I think, 46 pages long. So it's under 50, as we had said. But when we add the cover sheets and the tables and so on and so forth, it's probably another, I don't know, 5-6 pages or so. So it'll probably be about 52 to 54 pages totally. I went down to the post office today and to find out what it would cost for this mailing. And they do have a plan, a priority mail, flat rate envelopes, which only costs $7.49, no matter what the weight. And I took 50 papers with me down there to see how it fits. We could fit 100 pages in there. So it's got plenty of room in this particular flat rate envelope. Now, what we'll be doing is we'll be serving all of the defendants and some major players. Of course, we'll be getting copies out to the President of the United States, Attorney General Barr. We'll be getting a copy to him. Again, we'll be suing directly the United States Supreme Court and also both houses, so we'll be getting copies to those three parties. And we also will be filing a complete copy in the court. We've got a copy of a lot of the stuff and whatever we're missing, and of course this paper is going to be filed in the statutory court that we opened up for the purpose of having a place to put our paperwork so that we would be under the auspices of the court. Obviously, they've been rejecting, denying, and trying everything they can to keep us out. We'll be filing past indictments also in this common law court. We will be also filing joinders for all of the people that we have done habeas corpuses for and non-judicial foreclosures and maybe some other papers, CPS cases, and a few others. We'll be filing all those past papers, also joining them into the case as evidence. We'd like to make sure we get contact by these people. We'd like to get a joinders paper for them. If we don't get a joinders paper, then I'm not sure exactly how we're going to handle it. We'll definitely use it as evidence. There's no doubt about it. We've already filed it in the federal district court in the statutory side of things. We want to file it also on the common law, the natural law side of the court. So we are going to use it as evidence, no doubt about that. But we would like to push it further than that and get a judgment on these cases. So to demand that these people that have been injured be restored to their original state before they were assaulted by these courts. But if we don't get a joinder from you, we're not going to be able to push that part of what we would like to push. We've got about 60 or so cases, I think. Let me think. 20, 50, oh goodness, we have to have 70 or 80 cases, maybe even more than that, we've already worked with and are going to be filing in this case. We have a lot of people who want to join our case, and we're working through that process. So anybody that wants to join their case to ours, if you're being abused by the courts, you can go on to our website and get some information on that. Let me see if I can get this page open. Okay. If you go up to and click on due process on nationalalliance.org on the blue line, click on due process. Read this page very, very carefully. It's labeled abuse of power. Ask the question, stuck in an abusive court, and so on and so forth. And pretty much any case that you could have, we can attach. But as you come down, read through this page very carefully. Make sure you understand what we're talking about here. Then you can click the bottom to enter. And once you enter into that, this is a page that you have to be a premium member to get access to. Anybody could be a member, and of course you get access to all our pages except for this one. Premier access is anybody who is donating $5 a month or more. And that's only about $60 a year, so that's pretty cheap. But we give a lot of stuff here for free. You know, all the work we've been putting together and writing books. So we've got booklets here. We've got an 86 or something page or 96 page court access book, which lays out, you know, how to file a paper in the court, you know, gives you sort of an anatomy of a court case and gives you a lot of good information and stuff. You know, what kind of papers have to be filed and how you file them and the notice of motions and, you know, everything necessary in order to really go into the courts. We also have a lot of papers that we offer here that people can use. We've got a lot of forms, instructions, and forms to challenge jurisdiction. If people are pro se individuals and they're filing their own cases, want to take their own business, take care of their own business, you know, we've got some forms that they might be interested in using. I think they're very powerful forms. They're focused towards common law courts, and we're going to be spearheading that common law court opening up here in the Northern District of New York by the filing of this case in next week sometime. And again, there is a possibility we may not file it on Monday. We may end up filing it on Tuesday or Thursday or something like that. And I think that'll really have to do really with how we feel that the timing of what's going on in Washington. But I think it's going to be the 12th. We will read the case here on a Monday night program. Now, being about 40-some-odd pages, we're going to break it up into three parts probably. Three parts is about 15 pages apiece. We got a lot of footnotes in here, and we don't read footnotes, you know, sources and things of that nature. Some of these pages are more footnotes than it is, the words being spoken into the court. So we have a lot of sources, a lot of footnotes. So I think we could probably read these within 20 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes apiece, which is reasonable. It's going to be very powerful. And, of course, hopefully we'll be able to get some conversations caused by these readings and looking into these things. We will make it available online if we're going to file. If we file on Monday, then as we're filing, we will be releasing it on our website. We'll send out an email to let everybody know that we've released it and give them the location where they can find the paper and they can go up and read it themselves. Going back to the filing, we were talking about what it costs to mail out. We've calculated that, and we're looking for people to help us mail out as many as possible. Again, we're going to be filing the main papers, and we're going to be filing some of the all the evidence and memorandums and many, many different things and on hard copy on the court and also on the individuals we'll be filing, some as an information and some as defendants. But to the president, of course, and to Bill Barr, it'll be an information and also an order for moving towards execution of the results of our grand jury and trial jury. We're coming in as a tribunal. So we have done a lot of homework on working out the natural law process and the court system and what takes place in history. Everything we're doing has been done. May not have been done the way we're doing it in a sense that we may be doing three or four different things that were all done separately. So we'll be doing things collectively for the first time. But nothing we're doing is anything that hasn't been done here in America and or the creation and building of America, the founding part of America. But anyway, our calculation of cost comes up to be $8.30 for each mailing. It's $7.49 for the priority mail flat rate envelope. And then it is, we figure, you know, I looked up on Staples and you can get a ream of paper, which is 500 pages. for $7.49. So it's under $8, but with the tax, it's about $8 and change, $8.08, depending on, I figured 8%. So it comes up to be 80 cents per filing for a total of $8.30 for each mailing. So that's not too bad. So we really hope that we'll get a lot of volunteers prepped up and ready to go. We will get to those individuals, we will get a early release of the paperwork so that over the weekend they can be, printing them out, as many as they're going to file, and preparing them. And then they'll wait for us to give them the word to file wherever we ask them to file. Now, these papers, they'll have an ink seal instead of a raised seal. The papers we file in the courts and upon the United States Supreme Court and, you know, all the defendants and also information to the president and the Justice Department, all those will have raised seals on it. But the rest of them will have ink seals, which will be sufficient. We really are looking for people to make the filings to the federal district courts. There are 94 of them across the United States, and it includes also, some in other places outside the United States and the territories. But there's 94 federal district courts. We want to mail out one to each one of those federal district courts with the instructions that they, one page top we'll put on top with the instructions that they send a copy to all federal judges. We also would like to, and that's where we need the people to help. We got 94 at just about $8.50 a piece. So if people can do 5 or 10, you can get up to 10 out of a ream, a few pages short, because it's going to be probably 54 or so pages. But anyway, you can get copies of up to 10 out of a ream. And so anybody who's willing to send out 10 copies for us, it would really be appreciated. And it's what's necessary, really, to get the word out and get things going and to get copies to other people that need to see this. And hopefully, well, I believe it will shake a lot of people up in the judicial side of things on the state level to start thinking, well, maybe we better start obeying the law. So again, it's really important that we get as many people, volunteers, as possible. But if you could do 10, that'd be great. If you could do 5, that'd be great. And if you can only do 1, that'd be great. Just get a hold of Jan. Just let him know you're interested in helping. You can get his information on nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on the directory, and he's up toward the top. He's the national leader. Or you can send an email to him with your phone number and a note telling him you're interested in helping. You'll get out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever you can. And you can send that to Jan@nationallibertyalliance.org. Basically, we're going to be asking people to make these mailings, make sure, and we'll give an instruction. We'll have written instruction. It'll be very, very simple. An address on who you're going to send to. If there's 5 of them, we'll give you 5 addresses. And of course, on the return, we would want the United States, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury's address in their information on as the sender on this paper. So those are the two, really, that's 2 pieces of information that's only necessary to do this, and then the paperwork would be just a pure download and a printout. And then, of course, you go down to the we'll also include a copy to give a picture of what the priority mail flat rate envelope looks like. But if you use those words at the post office, if you're not sure, they'll give you the proper envelopes. And so again, for each mailing, which includes the paper and also the mailing itself, is about $8.30 a piece. So again, it's pretty cheap, and I think a lot of people should participate with us. Now, I've got a listing of about 1,000, maybe more. It's been a while since I looked at that, but I know it's over 1,000. Could be a couple of thousand contacts of media coverage across the United States, newspapers and different kind of media outlets. And I think I have all of the major outlets, television particularly outlets. So I'll be mailing out a bulk mail these papers to all of the news medias that I can reach. But there's a lot more than that. We will put a copy also for the general public download, where people can download them for their own purpose to read, and hopefully get out to people, share it with people, get it out to, you know, if you go to a place where you hear your news, maybe through YouTube or something, X22 or someplace like that, the X22 report, you know, or any of these other places, maybe you can get a copy to them. You can send them, maybe email them an electronic copy with a link to our site where they can also see it, not only download it. It may be a little, they may not necessarily download a file attached to an email, but you can give them the page and the website. Really, what we're trying to get is the exposure, and maybe we'll get some interviews out of this, and we'll get more exposure, and we're looking to hit that critical mass. We've been moving pretty good. In the last week or two, we've really been picking up some membership. So, you know, it's really, I think we're coming to that point, which we'll be hitting the critical mass, especially when the word gets out and people read the paper and also realize that they can join their cases to us and finally get justice and get these people off of their backs. So, again, everybody needs to participate. Maybe people will mail, will download a copy to get them to their local news or something. But anyway, we do want to hit all 94 federal district courts. We do want to hit a copy to all of the governors. And we'll put a cover sheet in there with the governor, with a mandamus commanding the governors to get copies to both of their houses within their state, so they get the legislative branch and the governor all in one shot. We might try to get a list, maybe the capital of the each state, get the whatever Supreme Court, you know, state court in one of the counties, which we'd probably choose, the, like I said, the capital, and maybe we'll get a copy to them with a demand to get it out to their judiciary. You know, as much exposure we can get to as many judges as possible and anybody within the judiciary anywhere, also in the legislative body and the administrative body as far as the governors would be, you know, all of this exposure is extremely important. And people may want to get it to other people. You know, again, you can just download a copy and drop it off at your sheriff, you know, and anybody you want to. Again, exposure is the key. And the people getting behind what we're doing and the critical mass and support from the president, which we do believe we have, and all that together collectively, that would give us success. The paper we wrote, and I don't say this lightly, you know, or just flung out there, the paper that we wrote, every page, every paragraph, every sentence, every word, is clearly, purely self-evident. Cannot be denied. There's no way they can rebut anything we have to say. You know, they'd have to shut down Thomas Jefferson, George Washington. They'd have to shut down, you know, American jurisprudence, many Supreme Court, great Supreme Court rulings over the past couple of hundred years. I mean, it is just absolute truth. It's very powerful. I think it's powerful. I'll get some thoughts and opinions after the committee takes a look, reads through it, and then we get together to, you know, kind of scrutinize it and correct things and so on and so forth. And it'll take away whatever's necessary. So again, this is what we've been working for. We started this way back, I think at the end of 2013 is when we became National Liberty Alliance. We were in the courts a couple of years before that, maybe 3 or 4 years before that. We started with our experiences in the courts. So we have about 10 years of experience focused in on the common law things, but also to understand the process, the procedure, what is equity, how does, you know, what is lawful equity. And we've got a good grip and understanding on that and their procedures and processes. They have no clue on how things work on the natural side of things, but we're going to educate them on that. And people need to be educated in this. The key thing to this is to take our nation back. You know, that's exactly why every week we say also please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. No, that's not it. I'm reading the wrong one here. What did I say? A note here. I thought that's... Oh, yeah, here. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right side of a website, which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Those are not just words. We truly mean that. It is the people. Only the people can save America, okay? President Trump cannot save America. President Trump, working with military intelligence and the entire military of the United States, cannot save America. They can put things back together again. They can put these people in jail and set us back on the right course. But if we, the people, do not step up and become reasonably educated and understanding of the law, our founders, and the basic history of America, and take control of our courts through the administration, we're going to tell you, we want to take the administration of the juries away from these criminals and put it into the hands of the people. If we don't do that, we're only going to end up back here again another day, just a matter of time. We need to take the political process back. We need to take the judicial process back. And National Liberty Alliance is teaching how to do both, where we can have 100% control of our country. 100%. Not 99, 100%. And be very few people who will be breaking the law at that point. But we'll catch them, and we'll get them, and we'll indict them. We'll remove them from office and do what has to be done. I'm not going to get into any of the details of the paper tonight. We're going to unfold it. And again, it's an extraordinary process and procedure that we've set up. It's an extraordinary action. And again, I really do think it's powerful. This is what we've been working for and towards for 7 years, since 2013. We've been working towards this point. You know, we've built this organization up to quite a few members. I think it's over 7,500. I think it's 7,600 members now. And we're looking for the critical mass. But in that process of time, building up that membership, we were educating people, making plans, and teaching people how to give consent to government. We have been filing papers. We have an open court case. We've been in trial. For 2 years, we have been in trial. And that's going to become very clear next week when we lay that out. We have filed over almost 200 pages. I think it's 194 pages, papers. We have filed in the federal court in this case already on the statutory side of things. We've denied their statutory process. We have denied their $400 requirement to open up a case. Although we did have to pay it because they wouldn't give us the number and wouldn't take our paperwork without it. We did it under protest, and we want our money back. We're going to get our money back. This next step is filing both in the same court where we have as a being under the auspices, but also a new way of filing. We put together something unique. Again, we'll talk, and you'll see that on Monday or as soon as we start revealing this information. So again, we need everybody's involvement in one way or another. Everybody, every member can do at least one. And even if they don't call up Jan or anybody to get into the part of the process of being given a particular individual to file it to, everybody can download it, get it to their local news. Everybody can download it, get it to their sheriff. And anybody you want, because everybody should have a copy of this, and the more the better. We need to get it out there. Okay, let me see. I think that might be it for now. Jen, do we have any announcements or anything going on?
Yes, I have one, and that's after you finished estimating the mailing costs to be... about $8.20, I sent an email to all 19 people who had signed up and volunteered to do mailings and asked, explained how we were going to do it, the fact that we wanted them to be mailed at approximately the same time, their date, and asked them how many they thought that they could actually mail. I was delighted to find that the first responder said that he could mail 25 of these out. Now, that was a really big surprise, and if we get a few more people who can do that, we should be able to cover the entire number that we have to mail with far less than the 75 to 100 people that we had originally estimated.
Right, but don't let that deter the people. We need more and more. We want to file it even more than what we can. We have a, you know, look at the
right.
Bare minimum for us to filing is the 94 federal districts and the governors. That's bare minimum. And, of course, all of the defendants. But, you know, we want to go further than that. And the other thing is people can share this through just sharing the page, the link where these papers are, will be found. And so they don't even have to print them out if they can get them out to news media and other places, explain a little thing. Maybe we'll write a news release. Matter of fact, we will write a news release on this. I'll make a note of that to write a news release. Go ahead, Jan.
Okay. The one question that had come up.
Yeah, you're breathing.
I have a problem in that distance doesn't seem to help. I'll try and talk softer.
Okay.
We need an estimate of about how many copies are needed per state. People are asking. I assume that they want to know if it's, you know, a small enough number they can just go ahead and do all of the mailings for one state, for their state.
Mm-hmm.
You have a rough number?
Well, yeah, you figure they probably have anywhere from 1 to 3 federal districts, depending on the size of the state, the population. New York has 4, for instance. Most states have 2 or 3, and some have 1. So whatever that would be on a state, let's say there's 2 federal districts to be mailed to, a governor to be mailed to, okay? And so that's the 3 main ones in the state. And, of course, we'd like to get a copy to maybe the chief judge in the capital for the state court. You know, here in New York, we call it the Supreme Court. I don't know what they call it in other states. Different states have a different name for their state court. But if we can get one, the other thing is that there is, I forget the number, but I think it's something like 13 or 14. I think 13 seems to jump up for some reason. Courts that handle the appeals, okay? And we want to get it to all of them. But, you know, if you want to mail it to maybe 5 in your state, you'd be hitting everybody we need pretty much, plus, you know, some others, really. And anybody, you know, everybody should try to get a copy to their own sheriff at least. So, again, you know, just getting this out, and you could share it electronically through email. You can share it dropping it off physically or mailing it physically or whatever. Okay, Jen, go ahead. So.
Okay, okay, that was the only announcement that I had for tonight. We do have 4 or 5 questions if you want to take questions now.
Okay, 2 questions.
The first one is regards to a United States Supreme Court case. It was Anderson versus Liberty Lobby Incorporated. It was number 84-1602, argued December 3rd, 1985, and was decided on June 25th, 1986. Now, the sender of this question said this is a huge case. Do we have it in our library?
What's the name of the case?
Anderson versus Liberty Lobby.
Yeah, I don't. That doesn't ring a bell for me, but that doesn't mean we haven't seen it and read parts of it. We don't
right.
have too many cases listed up on our website. You know, I think a lot of people, we do have landmark cases, and I don't remember how many we have, and maybe we'll add some more. But, you know, especially for beginners and different things, you know, reading those cases, the decisions wouldn't necessarily be the best thing in the beginning. But again, you know, people can start wherever they want. But that one doesn't ring a bell. So what else?
Next question. Here,
maybe
that
person get a copy, by the way.
Say again, please, Owen.
Maybe that person that asked about that case can get us a copy. Send us an electronic copy. You can get it to mail at nationallibertyalliance.org. Just attach it there and we'll get it.
Okay. I'll check on that. Okay, here in the state of Pennsylvania, there is pending legislation that would compel joining the other states currently operating under the national popular vote if passed. The piece of legislation is known as SB 270. The Presidential National Popular Vote Bill. My question on this is, if certain states are using the popular vote, would this reduce the number of electoral votes needed to declare a candidate a winner from the required 270 votes to a lesser number?
Well, look, I have to use this word. These morons have no clue on what they're talking about. Obviously, they have done no studying. They haven't looked into the founding of this nation. They haven't looked into the structure of our government and why it was structured that way. They clearly haven't read the Federalist Papers. They haven't even read the Constitution, okay? And that's why I call them morons. And I just need a strong word to refer to these people because they don't know what they're talking about. They're looking to really destroy America, and they may not even realize it. There is no way we can ever move to a popular vote. It's just not. It doesn't work. And you know, the people, the compromise. Okay, the compromise. The states were to elect the president. The compromise came with, okay, let's get each state will have so many electoral votes. And the people of the state will decide who gets those, you know, those votes. And so the compromise is to allow the people of the state on the popular end of the state to push all of these votes in. And then, of course, the states have their vote by filing those electoral votes. Now, I'm pretty sure most of the states, I think there's a couple of New England states, that allow their electoral votes to be divided. I don't know that that's constitutional or not. Maybe that is. I haven't seen anything in the Constitution which would deny that. But basically, most of the states have followed the idea that whoever wins the popular vote in that state gets all the electoral votes. So that'll never happen. It's like trying to get rid of guns in America. It's just never going to happen. And I think these arguments and these ideas, these ignorant ideas, will stop coming in about a year or so. Once the deep state is completely annihilated and gone, okay, and I think at that point a lot of these stupid things are just going to, you know, then people are not going to be saying stupid things like this.
Okay, next question. I have also heard rumors that Pennsylvania is trying to keep Donald Trump's name off the state ballot, and any write-ins would be particularly scrutinized in regard to spelling and capitalization, because if the slightest mistakes or implications are found, they would just discard the write-in.
Well, that sounds like they're trying to control the election, and that's against the law, isn't it? Look, that's not going to happen. That'll never happen. And if worse comes to worst, we have to play the game and get the Supreme Court involved. I'm sure they'll go the right way. It's just never going to happen. I don't know, strange, weird, disgusting, horrible. You know, it's apparent that these people are biased and probably guilty of something too, maybe even. I don't know. That's never going to happen. Anything else?
Okay, one more thing. I periodically hear of Article 5 constitutional conventions of the states. I hear about them a little more frequently because of the deep state's desperation for maintaining control. My question is, if the Constitution is amended, will NALA revise its civics and constitution courses to reflect the changes made to the Constitution?
Well, look, first of all, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. It's definitely not going to happen anytime soon. It takes a while to put that through. the requirements to get a constitutional convention requires two-thirds of both houses, and it still has to be ratified. I mean, there are so many things involved. It takes a long time putting it together. By the time anything like that even comes close to potentially even, you know, thought about really happening, I think the enemies of liberty will have been arrested and done away with at that point in jail or whatever, because that's where we're heading. We need to get rid of all of these deep state individuals that have been destroying America and destroying our liberty and pushing forward these different things. Look at why don't we start using the Constitution first before we start trying to amend it? Let's begin there. There's a lot of it that is just being ignored, and we are covering this in our case, you know, these details. That's not going to go anywhere, not for a long time. And I think by the time we get to the other end of these things, there's going to be a great elation across this nation when people really finally understand, when the full mass of people really come to understand what has been going on and what Trump actually has been doing and is accomplishing, the fact that he has saved America and brought us back to where we need to be. But, of course, then it's up to the people. And if we start educating the people, and that's what we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance, people need to get educated. If a people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. And of course, that's a Thomas Jefferson quote, and that's a fact. You know, if you're not going to get educated, you can't have liberty. You can't be free. You can't expect. It'll never happen. Okay? So that's the key, is education and taking control, consent of government, taking control of the courts, where the people should have control of the courts. Not the equity side of the court. That should be controlled by the judiciary. That's understandable. But the law side of the court was never meant to be controlled by the judiciary. No judges allowed, magistrates only. And that's for the sole purpose of them administrating the judge justice, the decision of the jury, and, putting the seal on it and putting that signature on it and pushing it forward for whatever execution is necessary to execute the decision of that court. And that is... where we have to take control. We, the people, have to take that control. So we have to take political control, and that's through the committee man process. We can do it. It's pretty simple. It's all about education. We have to take back the control of our judiciary, the courts of law, to maintain our courts, because the tribunal in a court of record, which is a court of law, which is a natural law court, the tribunal is the people themselves. And the people themselves, they decide the law. They decide the facts. They decide how to restore the individual, the penalty. They decide everything. The government is not involved here. You know, it makes me sick reading what we read tonight concerning the jury and the grand jury and the trial jury and how they've been stacked and controlled, tainted. And clearly, you see it right out of the handbooks. It's like you're in Russia or something, What TV programs do you watch? Do you watch cop shows? Which news do you listen to? Do you tune in on TV? What about the radio and your newspaper? What newspaper do you read? How old are your children? What's their sex? Do anybody have a permit to carry a gun? All these questions, who are these people to ask these kind of questions? It can only be for one purpose, and that's to get a psychological evaluation of the individual to see who they're going to put on what jury so they can get the outcome that they want, who they're going to discard and say, well, we don't need you. Thanks anyway. Come back. We'll call you another day. That's what it's all about. It's so clear what we read tonight and looked at in that memorandum. It is so clear. We have to take it back, otherwise we're going to lose it. So we also have to get schools educated. We get the education in the school, civics and a constitutional course in the schools, grammar school and high school, both levels. It's a necessity. When people come out of school, when people come out of the grammar school level, which I look at up to eighth grade, I've seen other places, they've judged the different levels, I think sixth grade and so on. But anyway, up to the eighth grade level. I think by the time people are in the eighth grade level, they should already know everything they need to know about this nation as far as the history of America, who we are as a people, what kind of law we're under, what is common law, what is equity, how does the system work. They should know all these things, okay, just coming out of eighth grade, but it should continue into high school. And we've put together booklets. We're writing a book. We're also going to take that book and turn it into a textbook for the schools, okay? Children need to know this. Because when they become adults, they need to take control of their nation. And anyway, what else we got? That's it, Jan?
Okay. Yep. Next question. I'm on the docket to challenge jurisdiction with CPS, and I'm going to court tomorrow by special appearance. Well, now I'm super excited, but CPS isn't answering any of my questions, and I have not seen my 5-year-old daughter since June 9th when they sent her to a foster home in El Paso, which is 7 hours away. I know they have 30 days, but they changed attorneys today, and I'm curious about what new can await me.
Well, is that not evil, or is that not evil? I mean, putting your child 7 hours away so the mother can't even visit their child, that's evil. That's pretty darn evil. Unless you really know what you're doing and you have some experience in the courts and you can write, I mean, we got the papers, you can download them, use them, but then you need to know what to do next. You need to know how to respond to the judge when he tells you that he's got the authority and he made the decision that he's got, he or she has the jurisdiction and can move forward. If you haven't got the experience in the courts and you don't have the experience of papers, you don't understand how things work and you don't know how they work and you don't know how it should work, you're not going to be successful in this. It would really be very, very, I'd be very surprised if they file a paper and they responded properly and did the right thing. It's not going to happen. But all I can tell you is you probably want to do a joinder with us. That, I think, is your best thing to do. But again, if you have experience in the court, you know, you could win as long as you got the proper knowledge and you can use our forms or you can create your own forms for writing these papers. But, it's an uphill battle, and these people are like the Gestapo. They don't care, and they break the law all day long. Half the time, I don't think they even realize it, all the evil that they do. I don't know how they sleep at night, but this is what they do. I suggest joining your case, or you're just going to have to wait until common law courts eventually open, which is at the end of our end game. So that's what we're pushing for now. Anything else?
Yes, the last question is, I'm asking about what can happen if we join our tax case with yours. Will it be dismissed, or are there other risks? If so, can you please specify what they may be including, as we were told, arrest scenarios which could apply? Also, I'd like to know how much time do we have and if the joiner can be accomplished within the next 2 or 3 months.
Well, joinders can be done immediately. The process could begin immediately. It depends on the people working with, getting the paperwork and going through the steps that we've laid out. And Jim walks everybody very carefully through the steps. Whenever anybody tries to jump a step or, getting ahead of a step, all that's going to do is slow them down. It's going to slow your case down because it's a problem. We have to stay in a dogmatic way and keep everything uniform and move forward and get things done right. When people jump steps, they get things done wrong. Wrong things are put in wrong places and all kinds of things. So we step people through. If you respond to Jim, generally speaking, it could be done rather quickly. Within a week, the paperwork could be filed. It could be moving towards filing. And the first paper we do is we do an amicus curiae on behalf of the defendant within the court that you're in, challenging jurisdiction and making the point that due process isn't being gotten, and then they have to respond. They'll probably ignore it, and that's okay with us, because then we'll default them, and then that's when we move them in as a joinder with another paper, and they have to answer that paper. And again, if they don't answer that paper, then they default. They will probably try to move toward Rule 12 to have it thrown out. We're not going to permit that. We're in a common law court. They don't know that yet, but they'll figure that out as time goes on. But we're not going to permit that to happen. And things move forward. We're looking to really, I think most cases are just going to default. And then we'll be filing papers of default papers, and moving the case that where the people in these courts have to be restored. We're going to push for restoring them to their original state, in the beginning. If we move them in, then we'll probably do a damage on top of that. We think we'll probably use $1,000 in silver coins, 1,000 silver dollars, which in money, dollars is about $18,000 today. So that would be probably, and that's for every injury, which would be denial of due process, particularly, okay, trying to take you into jurisdictions unknown, so kidnapping, so to speak, using the judicial machinery. Usually there's a couple of people involved, at least the prosecutor and the judge at bare minimum. In family court, sometimes there could be four or five lawyers. They try to give each child a lawyer, and in each of the individuals in there a lawyer. So if you got five children or four children, say you got five children and two adults, you got seven lawyers. And just imagine that, seven lawyers trying to tell a family how to live and what to do and survive. How does anyone survive under that kind of thing? You know, nothing but, again, nothing but pure evil from my stand, from my point of view. But anyway, that's sort of the process. And it takes 30 days at the point when we move the case. 30 plus days, maybe three or four more days. But in about 34 days or so after we file the first paper in the court, we will then be moving it and joining it. It'll be then joined. Then they got another 30 days to respond and answer. And then after that, the tribunal will make a decision. Okay, what else?
That's all the questions that I have for tonight, John.
Okay, great. Well, there's quite a few of them. All right, well, we're going to move over to Brent, and then after Brent, he's going to have 15, 20 minutes or whatever he needs, and then we're going to open up for an open forum. Anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 and 1. Brent, are you there? Looks like you're here.
I am. I'm here.
Okay, well, before I introduce you, just real quick, I'd like to drop a copy of the paper that we wrote here into your box there on Skype. And maybe get some comments from you. This is the unperfected one, though. You know, you'll find errors, but but it's really the meat of it. And so, if we drop it, if you can get back to me in a few days, I'd appreciate it and give me some thoughts. You know,
I'm looking forward to reading it, as always.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Well,
okay. Go ahead.
Okay, John, thank you. And again,
well, thank
my
you.
Comments,
well, let me introduce you first.
Okay.
Let me introduce you first. Okay.
Nice.
So we got Brent Allen Winters. He's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. Great book. Everyone should read this book. But anyways, the author of that book, The Excellence of the Common Law, his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the
thank
mic.
You, and I'm, of course, thankful that I'm allowed to say a few words, and my comments, as always, are my own. Nobody else's, just mine, and I make them on my own responsibility. I notice John, when he introduces me, he's very kind. He doesn't say Brent's a bar attorney. And, well, of course, one reason why he doesn't say that, because I'm not a bar attorney, but I am an attorney, and there's a difference. But we have a common interest in the law, because the law is the way things are and they won't change. That's what the law is. What is. If it, what is, that's law. It's not going to change. That's why we say, of course, there's only one true lawgiver, the author of the laws of nature of our Declaration of 76, the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of creation, unwritten, lex non scripta, as Blackstone tells us, and the laws of nature's God, the second volume, is written, says Blackstone, and we call that the Bible, the final rule of life, final, the court of last resort, expressed. Now we're talking about the law unwritten. Our Constitution of the United States is written, but it's written not as an unchangeable rule. It can be changed. It can be amended. It can be altered. It can be added to. It could be taken away from, but not without a whole lot of struggle and difficulty, and it's intended to be that way. But we recognize that it is an expression. It is another expression of our common law, the laws of nature, lex non scripta. And I understand it's in writing, but our common law and our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. Our common law is our Constitution. I say, as I say often, I say now again, it bears repeating, that on the 14th of October, the year 1775, our Congress assembled for the first time. I believe it was in Annapolis, Maryland, and they made the point. They said that they wanted to, essentially, I'm not quoting, but they wanted to reestablish the freedoms of our Constitution. Well, our Constitution wouldn't be written for another 12 years. That was 1774, 13 years it was, 14 October 1774. And they said that they wanted to enjoy the liberties of their Constitution. Well, what do they mean by saying that? Well, they're talking about their Constitution as British men and women. And they knew that their Constitution, just like the people in England would have said, their Constitution, it was their common law, and it was unique in the world. It didn't exist anyplace else, and it only exists in about five major countries in the world today. All the rest of the world is under some form of the law of the city. We are a common law country. That's the law of the land. That's why our Constitution says this Constitution is the law of the land, Article 6. That means it is the way things are done, due process. Our Constitution is the way things are to be done. Doesn't tell us what's to be done. Doesn't tell us who the president is, who the senators are. It tells us how they get there. It doesn't tell us how we punish people for crimes or convict them. It tells us how, and it says, of course, that we do it according to the course of our common law. Well, what's the course of our common law? It's due process. That's the way we get things done. It's process-oriented, not result-oriented. We're in our Constitution of the United States, that brief of common law government. We're in Article 1. We're moving through clause by clause, blow by blow. We're in Section 9, Clause 8. Section 9, Clause 8. We're going to finish this up. I want to read it. I won't say anything about it much today because we talked about it last Monday. We'll move on then quickly to the next one, but the two go together. That's why it's important I read this one, then I'm going to read the next one. This one says, no title of nobility shall be granted by who? Well, by the United States, the general government in Washington, D.C., and no person holding any office or profit or trust under them, under what? Them, plural? Plural, not singular, them. Well, the states united, the United States, you see, they acknowledge that here, shall, without the consent of Congress, except of any present emolument, office, title, or of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. Notice there, it's not a prohibition against titles of nobility. This clause is not an absolute prohibition against titles of nobility. It says there, and I read it close, says there, without the consent of Congress. Now, some people say that just applies to a person holding an office of profit or trust, shall not accept any present emolument, office, title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. Well, but it says without the consent of Congress. It's axiomatic that that means in the positive, that's the negative, in the positive, with the consent of Congress, such things can be accepted. Now, I don't know of any time that Congress has ever consented to this. You know, back during about 100 years ago, there are a lot of American boys that received great honors from France in battle honors and awards. Was that with the consent of Congress? I don't know the answer to that. Might have been. But I want to know what it says here for sure. And this is not an absolute prohibition against titles and nobility. But it is a prohibition. It's just not absolute. The exception is if Congress consents. Now let's go to the next clause, Section 10, Clause 1. It says, no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of mark or reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold or silver a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility. Now, there it is again, see? Grant any title of nobility. Now, notice the difference. In this clause, each of the states of the United States are absolutely, the Constitution absolutely bars them from granting a title of nobility, whereas the government of the United States in Washington, D.C., can do so with the consent of Congress. That's the difference. That's one of the differences. And remember, a title of nobility is just not a title. We have all sorts of titles. We have my uncle, John Will Henry Hudson, my granddad's brother. He had a title. It was a title that's well accepted by custom and law. And the title was he was an auctioneer. So they called him Colonel. Colonel John Will Henry Hudson. Colonel. Because auctioneers in America are traditionally called Colonel, with the rank of Colonel. Why do they receive the rank of colonel? Well, because after the war between the northern and southern tiers of the states, all sorts of carpetbaggers were coming into the South. So that's a word, by the way, that describes Jewish people that came into the South to buy up land cheap and sell it in parcels and divvy it out and make a lot of money. And they held auctions. Well, the abuses became so great, the abuses of doing that, that the federal government, the government of the United States, passed a law in the southern states because they were occupied under martial law that nobody could hold an auction down there unless they were of the rank of colonel of the United States Army or above. And ever since then, auctioneers have been called colonel. So my uncle was called colonel. He'd write on the sale bill, it'd say farm sale, and it'd say Colonel John Will Henry Hudson. Auctioneer. Well, is that against the law? No, that's not against the law. Well, what about the state of Kentucky? I'd mentioned them last time. The governor of the state of Kentucky, by legislative authority, can issue the title Kentucky Colonel. Kentucky Colonel. I've met a couple of fellows that were Kentucky Colonels. As I'd said last week, Kentucky Colonels was an organization. That was a veterans organization of veterans that lived in Kentucky that were veterans of the war for separation from Britain, our war of independence, as we call it. But today the colonel does have that authority, but does that make it a title of nobility? You know, the Constitution of the United States is an absolute bar to the states, state governments, from granting titles of nobility. And we said last time, I want to repeat this too. A title, there's a lot of titles, Mr., Mrs., when I was a little boy, I'd get letters in the mail. This is very common back when I was a boy, and the letter would say, Master Brent Allen Winters. And I was taught, when grade school, I was taught that when I write a letter to someone that was under the age of majority, 21, the proper way to address a letter was Master. Now, can you believe they taught me that in a little town in the Midwest? But they did. I was taught that, and I remember getting letters like that. Master Brent Allen Winters. Is there a law against it? No. That's not a title of nobility. Medical doctors have doctor in front of their name. Lawyers sometimes use the title Esquire. Sometimes people use it with lawyers. There's no law that says they have to. It's a, what we'd call a title of respect of their particular position. Doctor, master, if a guy have a master degree, they used to do that. Titles of nobility are hereditary. You can pass them along to your heirs. They do pass along, as a matter of fact. They do pass along. And when you have a title of nobility, for example, in Britain today, if you're a knight, like one of the members of the Beatles of the 1960s, McCartney, the Queen knighted him. So he's Sir. Is his name John? Whatever it is, it's Sir. Let's say his name is John. Sir John McCartney. Well, is that a title of nobility? Yes, it is, because if he has any heirs, any sons, they will receive that title. No, it's not a matter of who he chooses to give it to. Now, the old law says that his oldest son gets it, whether his oldest son wants it or not. That puts him in a unique position. Of course, titles of nobility over there, that allows you to serve in the House of Lords because you become a lord, knight, lord, and you're called sir so-and-so. All three of those words refer to the same title of nobility. Well, if you receive a foreign title of nobility, for example, if the Queen of England were to grant knighthood to John, he'd have the right, to be a part of the House of Lords. Well, the House of Lords in England is the court of last resort. It's the Supreme Court of England, not to mention the upper house of the legislative body. Combines the legislative and the judicial function together, which is okay at common law in England. Now, you can't combine three. That's the problem. Our common law says without exception, you never combine three. In America, we've gone a step further and say we don't even want to combine two. The branches of the government are separate. And a fella can't belong to one and belong to the other, with some exceptions. But by and large, you're not to be working in the cabinet of the President of the United States while you're serving as a United States senator from one of the states. That's against the law. Of course, our Constitution doesn't say that point blank. But when you ensure that our unwritten Constitution, our common law, when you ensure that it informs the Constitution of the United States, which it must, or the Constitution of the United States becomes a meaningless and dry and dispirited skeleton of words, the common law is behind every word of our Constitution. Well, if you ignore that part of it, yeah, it becomes meaningless. So is it important that we pay attention to these two clauses, one applying to the general government in Washington, D.C., and the other one applying to the state governments as an absolute bar? Without exception, never can titles of nobility, any state grant titles of nobility. That's the difference between the two clauses, and if we remember that, we've learned a whole lot. Well, let me see what I've said here about this second clause, no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, confederation. Okay, I get it. Hey, that's applicable. That's really applicable. What did this war we had between the North and the South, what happened there? Well, those states down there, they entered into alliances and treaties, and they joined themselves together in a confederacy. It says no state shall enter into any confederation. They did that. Of course, their argument was, we're not a part of the Union anymore, so we can do what we want. In other words, if we break away from the Union first, then join ourselves into a confederacy, we haven't violated the principles of the Constitution of the United States. But, of course, the northern states disagreed with that take on the situation. Secondly, it says no state shall grant letters of marque and reprisal. Marquis, that's the way the French word would read. Why do we have a French word in here? Well, because our common law is filled even yet today with a bastardized form of the French language called Norman French. You see, the Normans left the coast of France. They were from Norway. They lived on the coast of France. They'd conquered it about 165 years earlier. And then they left the coast of France, and they decided they would conquer England, and they did, believing that William the Conqueror, they called him William I, that he was the rightful heir. And the woman that sits on the throne today in England is a granddaughter, many generations down, but a granddaughter of that man, William the Conqueror. He himself was called William the Bastard, or people called him that, I should say. And usually they'd get their heads chopped off their shoulders if they did, if he called them, but that's what they called him because that's what he was. Nobody knew who his father was. That's not a criticism of him at all, because it's not his fault that that happened. But truth is, the boy was real sensitive about it. You didn't say that in his presence or even hint toward it. And there are a lot of people that learned that the hard way. It didn't do them any good. They were out of the picture by the time they suffered the consequences of their impropriety. But French, they lived on the coast of France, so they learned the French language when they invaded England in 1066, again on October the 14th. The French language, they won. The French language became the language of the government of England. And that is why, friends, neighbors, and kin, that is why our common law is filled. Our courts today in every state are filled. Even in Louisiana, which is the only non-common law jurisdiction in the United States because of the French influence. But even there, the courts are filled with French because of the French influence. Well, we, of course, our common law is shot through. The French. One of the best known French words in our common law tradition is the word petition. Petition. It's in our Constitution. That comes from the French influence of the Normans, who still, of course, control the government, but we no longer speak their language. There were so many Anglo-Saxons in England. There were only about 6,000 of these Normans that spoke this bastardized Norman French that came to England, but they controlled everything. So if you wanted to go into court back in those early couple of centuries after 1066, and you couldn't speak French, well, you couldn't go into court. And that's how lawyers, common law lawyers, arose, by the way. If somebody could speak both tongues, Anglo-Saxon and French, they could go into court for a person who had a problem, an elderly person or an orphan or somebody, and they could interpret. They could talk to the court, and they could give the court, who only knew French, they could make the case for this poor person that didn't have anybody to speak for them. And that from that experience arose a class of men who not only then knew both tongues, but also began to learn. Well, the truth is they knew the common law. Here's what happened. They knew the common law because the common law was the law of the Anglo-Saxon and the Anglo-Dane, which were the Vikings that had mixed their blood with the Anglo-Saxons. They understood that. And they understood the common law. That was the common law of the Danes and the Angels and the Jutes, which were the Danes, the Angels, and the Saxons. And the other Germanic tribes, including the Norwegians, the Scandinavian and Germanic tribes, the Norwegians and the Swedes, which were Sweden was settled by Anglo-Saxons, and a fellow by the name of Gedin. They were all the same fundamentally. They spoke like tongues, and they had a like government. And that government, they called their, in the Germanic Scandinavian tongue, they called it Volkreich. Volkreich, which means Volk, means folk, F-O-L-K, we say. We still speak a Germanic tongue, Anglo-Saxon. Folk, Reich. Well, we get our word right, R-I-G-H-T. It means duty. And Folkreich, or Volkreich, means the people's duty. And the people in those old days had two duties, the men. The people are the men. And they had two duties. Militia duty, which they called the Third Fair, and jury duty. And that's where we get our oath that our Constitution of the United States demands of every office holder of federal and state government to defend the Constitution of the United States. Well, see, that's the law of the land. To defend it, and when you defend the law of the land, you defend the land itself. To defend the law of the land, our Constitution, against enemies foreign, that's militia duty, see, as a member of the ancient Third Fair, the militia a-going, as the Anglo-Saxons used to say. That's domestic. That's foreign, and members of the Third Fair. And domestic, that means you will serve on the jury or bring suit in defense of the land and the law of the land when you believe it's necessary to do so. Against our enemies, foreign, that's willingness to take up arms, and domestic, that's willingness to serve on the jury. So these Anglo-Saxons, of which there were almost a million in those early days in England, and there were only 6,000 of these Normans, these Anglo-Saxons knew the common law. The Normans didn't. They'd lost it. They had the imprint of Rome by the time they got there. They'd been on the Roman coast for 165 years. So because this class of men arose that knew the common law, but they didn't know the language, but they came in as mediators to stand between the court and the accused, to speak the language of the court, and then to talk to their client in the language of the accused. And that's how the common law was preserved in England, because William I, when he got there, he didn't know the common law, but he said as soon as he got there, the common law will remain in force. That was the habit of the Normans wherever they went. They conquered the coast of France. They conquered Sicily. Roger II was brother to William I of England, the William the Conqueror. He conquered Sicily. Another brother conquered Constantinople. These folks went everywhere. They liked to get on ships, and they like to go whoop people. That's what they did. But the thing that they did, everywhere they went, it was always the same. They never instituted their own law. They always said that the law will continue, whatever the law was there in Sicily, it was the law of Rome, for example. In Constantinople, it was the same Roman law, the Code of Justinian. But when they got to England, he said the common law will stay in force. Well, England was unique that way, and the Normans didn't know anything about the common law. They had been Romanized on the French coast. So it's just a matter of circumstance that these men arose that learned both languages and were able to preserve our common law. One of the great quirks in the events of history that our Maker has used to preserve the law of the land. Well, a bit of history about our common law. That's why we have what we call common lawyers, and their job is still the same, to understand obscure French Norman words and to educate the court, like petition. Now, that's not a bad one. I'll tell one story and then I'll quit. I went into court in a place called Jasper County. It's a rural county back home in the Wabash Valley. And I got done with the case, and the other lawyer on the other side, I said something, and the lawyer on the other side said, "Judge, I move to strike that." He said, "What for?" He said, "Because it dehors the record. It dehors the record." Well, all I could think of when he said that was something about women of the night, dehore. I didn't know what he was talking about. So he said, "What are you talking about?" Judge didn't know either. And he said, "Well, it's outside the record." The judge said, okay, if it's outside the record, then I'll strike it. But I didn't know what you meant by what you said. Well, of course, I went home. His challenge wasn't lost on me. I went home and I looked it up. Dehore. You can find it right in Black's Law Dictionary. D-E-H-O-R. Dehore. With a rough breathing in front, it'd be like a W. Dehore. And what it means is, it doesn't mean to throw the ladies of the night out of the case. It means to that anything that is outside the whore, we get our word horizon from that. I misunderstood what he was saying. Horizon. Outside of the horizon. What's the horizon? Well, that's the boundary. Outside the boundary of the record that's in the case, well, he wanted to strike that. So there's another French Norman word. I learn more all the time as I read law. Our system is shot through with these Norman French words, and I have found, and I like to do it too, lawyers take particular delight in mispronouncing such words. So I use them. Sometimes I like to throw them at judges because it keeps things a little more interesting. Every once in a while, I'll throw something like that in bring a little levity, give a lift to the otherwise boring proceedings. Thank you very much, John, and back to you. Enjoyed it.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. All right, we're going to move over to Q&A. Again, if anybody has a question or a comment, anything to share, *6 and a 1. And we'll take our first caller here. Maybe caller, is that 281 area code? Let me unmute you. Maybe you can give – oh, okay, it's Corey from Illinois.
Yeah, hey, John. How you doing?
Good.
Nice, terrible experience on Thursday night coming back from the Canadian border at Detroit. And curious anybody else had the issue out there. I didn't have anything illegal in my vehicle. They searched it, but then they proceeded to want all the codes to my phones and computers and with no probable cause. So when you say there's not much constitution left, you're absolutely right. They didn't care about the Fourth Amendment, you know, when I mentioned that. And I reminded them of their duty to the Constitution. They didn't seem to care about that either. So they confiscated my phones when I refused to give them the code just on principle. And so I just kind of want to share. That wasn't really a question. I didn't know if anybody else has had that problem. I heard there was a journalist a couple months ago.
What state were you traveling through?
I was coming from
Toronto.
Michigan. I was in Michigan, Wayne County, coming into Detroit on the Ambassador Bridge there, the big bridge. And so I was on the American side. I'm a U.S., natural-born U.S. citizen being treated like that. It's just unbelievable that they just disregard the Constitution like they do in these border regions with no probable cause. And that's apparently they've been getting away with it, and I guess Electronic Frontier Foundation has got a big lawsuit about it. Trying to get the Rutherford Institute or maybe the Pogo Institute or something to take my case and challenge it a little bit. So,
The tides, they are changing. Again, with what we're doing, and I think the timing is right. What's going on in Washington, D.C., as I mentioned earlier, is right. Q says August is going to be a hot month, and we'll be filing right there in the center of August, on the 12th or during that week. So we're pretty much close to the center of August. So our timing should be right. Our papers should be hitting at the right time. And look at we have a really, really great shot at taking back this nation by taking back our judiciary and taking back our political process. But it's going to require the people. Only the people can do this. And so, therefore, we need that critical mass. We need the education to the people. We need the people not only get educated, but if they have cases, to join them to our case. We need the people behind this process. I do believe that we're going to get the president behind us. Q has already, I've been told, has commented on things that we spoke about when we were on the Patriot, soapbox. I don't know, remember what it was that Q had said, but commented when I was talking about something. They said he was commenting to what I had said. So we got support there, it looks like, and we got a real attorney general. Not that Session wasn't real. Session did his job. You know, Q has always told us, trust Sessions. We still need to trust him because he had prepared thousands and thousands of indictments that he had gotten through. And now Barr moves in, and he is now the new guy to take us to the next stage. So, but look, when we read through this paper, when people read this paper and really take their time to understand what we're saying, I think it's clear on how things ought to be, what the law requires, and that the people are ultimately the tribunal in a court. It's not a judge. And once we start, and we also make the note and the motion to the fact that we're looking to take the administrations back, we clearly prove without any doubt, self-evident, just by opening up their jurist handbooks or their, trial jury handbook or something, whatever they call it. And just by opening that shows that they have totally tainted the jury.
The
orders that they give, all these things collectively, okay, they all now, they have to be done away with, and we have a really great case to make the case, and we're only moving it back to where it belongs, back to the people. It's the people who decide. Yeah. It's the people of the grand jury. They decide to consent or not consent to, an indictment. It's the people who judge and decide both facts and law, et cetera, et cetera. And so once we get to that point and the administrations of the juries are the people and we train the people in that, you orientate the people within that 6 or 8 hour period that we have to prepare them for the job as a jurist or, grand jury or petit jury, all of that and then access of the people to the administrations, In other words, if you want to talk to the jury, you have every right to talk to the grand jury. You should be able to be put onto a schedule to go in there and say your piece. No one should be prevented of that. That's an unalienable right to go talk to the people have the power to do something to help an individual. And, of course, you know, they cut us off from that. Again, proof that they are not worthy to be trusted with the people's business at all. But once we're at that point, that'll never happen to you. And if it does, then justice will prevail. And you'll be able to find and seek justice and get it quickly in any county.
Is there any kind of a federal filing that would be different you could recommend to sue the Border Patrol for violating the rights and holding me 5 hours with, you know, not doing anything illegal and
seizing
my devices?
You could win a case like that. It's possible, difficult, but possible. But you'd have to understand how things work, and you have to be on top of the case. You have to really have a good plan and really put the stress upon the judge because they're all looking to maintain the status quo. I don't think you'll get anywhere today, but when you get onto the other side, and the other side meaning of what we're doing, which we'll be filing next week, so maybe it'll take months or a period of time before we actually get in there. But once we get on that other side where the people finally take control of the judiciary, the judicial process of law, and on the other side, the political process, then, yeah, you have a – I think you can get justice at that point. So make a documentation. Write your affidavits now and wait till we get to the other side.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, guys. Appreciate everything you're doing.
Okay. All right. We'll take our next caller. Let's see. It's Crystal from Connecticut. How you doing, Crystal? You got the mic.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Hello. Good.
Okay. What's happening? They want to put me out of my house. They want me out of my house by tomorrow. And
they moved back to that?
Yeah, well, they put the... Excuse me, because I'm not feeling all that good right now. They they put the objection, which was only an application, which was signed off by an attorney who I never even heard of. So what I did was I went back and I filed another police report, which the police department did not want to take the application, which I thank Jehovah God. I was filing all my police reports from day one, you know. And when I sent you the documents, and that's what I told everybody here, file the police reports because these are illegal documents, what they're doing to us. I picked all mine up, and remember when they did the illegal foreclosure, and I had my warranty deed, and I had life use and everything. You know, I tell people all over the country I'm that. Well, on January, then when this is the third time, they try to put me in the foreclosure. And I said, show me, and I did everything with the affidavits. When I started out in 2014, I would like to see the contract from Mr. G, Federal Credit Union. I said, show me the proof of claim. I did the subrogation. I did everything. And I said, here's my proof. And I said, and then when I found out they took out $250,000 from the GE Federal Credit Union, but it went into somebody's pockets, okay? So another thing, too, whenever anyone files a case or claim, you have 1 year to prove that case. You know, show proof of claim, due process, or the contract, whatever. Otherwise, the case has to be discharged. They turned around, and this is what they put, this has been going on since 2014. What year is this? 2019. And to this very day, they still never showed no contract with me. Where is the money? And other people investigated, which I used to do that work and do the recording, you know? And see, another thing too, when they were changing people's mortgages, and I kept on telling them, when they went to get an attorney, and they said, well, get an attorney. No, I'm not going to get an attorney. I said, because I don't need you to know why I'm here. And the best advice, when I started back in, what was it, 2013 or whatever, 2014, am I a public servant of this court? And the judge said, no. Is there a sheriff here? No. Is this my common law jury? He said, no, I'm the common law jury. I said, then I turned around and said, I would like your resignation. You just committed treason. He told me to get the hell out of his courtroom. You know, and I said, and everybody was in the courtroom like looking at it. I said, wait a second. And then I remember the affidavit. Anytime you go into that courtroom, so I sent the attorneys all of them, this is my sworn affidavit of truth, you know, and I want a sworn notarized affidavit from Mr. GE Federal Credit Union, from Mr., and, you know, because the attorneys, Judith Epstein, with that WPCA, people are losing their homes for 4 cents because they're charging a sewer bill and a WPCA bill, which is a bill that was created, which is only nothing but a utility bill. And when the people were sitting there signing up for the attorneys, and I was looking at some of the documents, I said, wait a minute. I said, but your house is paid for. You got your warranty deed on this, you know? And people go, I have to get an attorney. Well, of course, when they got the attorney's slapping the fee back on your property, and they end up with your property anyways, you know? So when they bought that, and I say you taught us so much, and like everybody, I was with a group of retired police officers this week, and I said, well, who's the highest in the court? And they were like, well, it's the judge. No, I said, it's the sheriff. And they're like, ah, you know, I said, that's why we never get nothing done, because no one knows the law, and people are jerking us all around. And so when I went to file my police report again today, because they denied me, and they told me I could not file, and I said, this one, oh, this guy, he was so nasty, arrogant, right? He goes, well, I feel you don't even have a case, and I'm not taking nothing. I said, I'm not here for you to decide or judge or anything else. This is a criminal case because here I have my warranty deed and I have my quick claim. And on January 18th, which was they wanted to take my house on the 19th, he went and somebody falsified and he terminated my name off my property and put his name on the property on January 18th, and then turn around and sold to his friend or whoever. And now they got the E. So what I did, because I know this work, and I did this work for almost 49 years, I went and refiled, and it's back in my name. So they started going off on me, and I'm like, here's the property. So everybody, and so now everybody's looking at my case, and you have the copies of that also, John. I passed mm-hmm. over to you and everybody
well,
else.
Look, you know, this is, again, nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action. And this
yeah.
judge thinks that he is the law. This
oh.
judge thinks that what he says is the law. And he's not alone in this. All of these town courts, the village courts,
wait
the
a
city
second.
Courts,
you know
they
ahead
all
of yourself.
Think the same thing.
I have to say this to you. No judge signed off on this. This is...
I know.
An attorney who I never even
yes,
heard of.
That's why they call it a non-judicial foreclosure, and it's sanctioned by the court without a court signature, a judge's signature.
Well, no, this guy signed off on it, but he got a nice little surprise coming too. So, like, everybody, I guess, there, people are now rallying around me because the media, people are applying. As a matter of fact, what you definitely need to do, and everybody needs to contact the Congress, especially the state of Connecticut and all the rest of them, because this
well,
is going to get...
Let me ask you a question, though. What's the status of your situation now tomorrow? Or is the sheriff, well, they don't have a sheriff there, so who comes out?
They have
out?
A marshal. I have no trespassing.
The marshal... The marshal, you might want to make a note to the marshal. Is he going to come out tomorrow? Do you believe he's going to come out
no,
and try to...
No, he sent... They, see, They said it was the 22nd that I received it, but I did not receive it until last Wednesday, the 31st. So they hold on to it. So and I got sick.
So what's
the status? I'm sorry.
What's the status? What actually
They want me out the house by tomorrow night. On if I'm not out by tomorrow night, on Wednesday morning, they are going to come and eject me from my house. Well, I'm a total disabled person with my warranty deed, and I have my no trespassing sign. You know.
Okay, why don't you get a hold of Jim? And what you're doing is fine, but why don't you get us to do a paper for you? You should have done this a while ago because we need to move it. You need to move this case.
Well, I'm not going back in the court. This is what got the thing. I want you to just stay close by because we have the radio. We got a lot of coverage pertaining to this, and people have been following my case because a lot of people lost their homes illegally. And another thing, too, I have to say to everybody listening to this call, make sure you go and check on your deed, on your land records, because what's been happening, and I guess it's been happening all over, and I do recall before I left my job, that they were changing, people were just going in and changing people's documents. And so, like, especially now, they got about, there was about 9 people on my street, and I'm like, whoa, and we're all in the age of 60. They sat there, and, you know, it's like a cholesterol what they're doing to people. Make sure you check your deed record and get copies every few months, okay? Because what's happening, there's people that have died and or they are senior citizens that have that might have passed away. And all of a sudden, when the family goes for the estate or whatever, their attorneys are saying, oh, that's not your property. They sold the property. And they're like, the family, what is it? You know what I'm saying? Because the family
mm-hmm.
has expired.
Yeah, it's just fraud. More fraud on top of fraud, yeah.
That's right. And this is a big time, and this is going on all over the country. And I remember there was a few that I did was able to save, and I'm like, wait a second. And remember when I went back, then they turned around and deleted my records, and they said I act like I just bought my house to cover themselves from the 14th, 2014. They put like I just bought the house in 2015, you know? And I said, what the hell's going on with these records? So we have it, and everybody, you've got the copies of all that. But, and then when they sat there and changed my records on the 18th, when they did the supposed illegal foreclosure on the 19th, which we have the sign of that. So how could you change a record before it even transpired? But see, those are the things, you know. And do not sign anything. Do not sign.
Well, look it. Get a hold of Jim. And,
I don't have his number. You want me to get to?
Just send him an email. Well, maybe give a call to Jan, and he'll give you Jim's number. Okay,
yeah, okay,
call Jim.
I've been trying to
get
your
paper. We'll get your paper out. You can follow up with a request for joinder after. But let's get a paper out. We'll try to get it out tomorrow. Maybe Jim can get it out tomorrow. He could fax it over to you, and you can go serve it. At least it's something that'll help to protect you.
Right.
And it's a challenge of jurisdiction, okay? And also, it's very clear on what has to happen. It has to be decided. Jurisdiction now must be decided. They can't just go forward with this without it. But this should protect you. But also, at some point, you know, we will move after 30 days. We move this into the federal court, and now it's out of their hands altogether. Now,
well,
this is where you need to build. Even though you're doing what you're doing, you know, mm-hmm. you should protect yourself from the other side of things also. You need to do something.
Absolutely, but I don't want to be back in their crazy jurisdiction because did you just see Wall Street just now? I'm sorry. Did you just see
you
what's
get
going
out
on?
Of it.
Yeah.
Look, it's a violation of your unalienable right of due process, okay? They can't Amendment 4, they can't just come and seize your property and take your
things.
John,
I got the property. What they did was criminal, and it's all
but
in writing.
There's nothing more dangerous than ignorance and action. You don't think that they're going to come out Wednesday now?
Oh, they probably will, but the media and everybody's coming out too. But I got all my legal documents. You know what I'm saying? That's why now they're all like, they want to sit there and file. And I says, who changed these documents? Because it was criminal.
Okay.
So
I think they are so bold they may even ignore the fact that the media is there and still go forward. So you got to be careful of this.
I understand. And you know what? The governor, the attorney general, Blumenthal, I notify them with whatever they're going to do about it. But everybody's on the case because people have been watching my case all over. And everybody, number one, hey, just keep abreast on what's going on because, you know what I'm saying? I'm letting you know what's going on.
All right. Look, if you want us to help you get all the gym
I
tomorrow.
I definitely do. But as I said, I just need to...
Call Jan and have him connect you with Jim.
Okay, we'll do that.
And Jim's on the call right now, I'm sure. And, Jim, you just go forward right away with the paperwork. Just get the information real quick and get that paperwork in, the amicus curiae. We can fax it over to there to Crystal, or we can email it to family. Serve it tomorrow. Serve it upon. Make sure even the marshal gets a copy of this, okay? And they have to answer this. They can't just go forward at this point. They got to at least try to have one more hearing. And look, we'll push it as fast as we can. Now that we're filing next week, okay, we'll be able to move a case in next week if we have to. You know.
But John, also the executive order that Trump put through December 21st, 2017, we put everything together. I got a whole package that people definitely need to know because, number one, they have no money, and this is all criminal. Remember that last time we did that? They turned around and charged me $400. I said, this is just removing one court to the
other. But you don't have to worry about that anymore because you're not doing it on your own. We're doing it for you.
I understand.
You did some. And you can understand certain things in the filing, and they got you for that $400. They did get you for the $400, right?
No, they said they were going to send it back, but I got a call to find you.
Yeah, okay.
No.
Well, look, forget about that, because, unless you have the experience to go into a federal court and deal with the problem, they're just going to railroad you there, too. Those judges are as crooked and evil the other judges. Only difference is if they are concerned on what you know and the things you say and how you move the case and what you write and what you say and then they start wondering about you and they get a little nervous about you because they know they're breaking the law and they know they can get away with it, but they also know that there's a good chance they may not get away with it if someone comes in and knows what they're doing. You know, if it's a lawyer coming in that knows what's going on and tries to do something, the judge can have a control over him by taking him into the back room and letting him know this is the way things are going to go and threaten his license. Because, again, these judges, they're all about the status quo. And that's all
right.
It is. There's nothing,
right
nothing
now
more.
With the
Try to button this up because you've been on 20 minutes and we do have a lot of people in the queue.
Okay.
So.
All righty. But, yeah. Okay. Thank you. But, yes.
Again, get to the gym tomorrow, Crystal. I really think you need to get us to help you with that paperwork to get it in for you.
Okay. All righty.
All right. And if you need to talk to me, I'm very difficult or hard to get to, especially lately with writing the paper, and I got a lot of things going on.
And I'm getting a lot of people recruited with this, too, the students and all.
Okay, you can call Jan, and Jan can usually find me. I may not be able to talk long, but if you need to talk to me, go through that route.
Okay, we'll do. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye. Okay, let's take our next caller. It is Robert. Go right ahead, Robert, 954 area.
Yes, hi. This is Jason.
Oh, Jason. Go right ahead, Jason.
Yeah, so I have been dealing with the family court for going on about 5 years now. Unfortunately, last year, my father, my brother, and my mother died, and been dealing with the probate courts and all of that, but I am behind with regards to child support and child support arrears. And I filed several different motions with regards to jurisdiction. Of course, everything was ignored. They then moved, the state came in with the Attorney General and moved to intervene, and then they've been coming at me twice as hard, and now they've recently filed for a contempt of court, which they were able to get, and then they filed a writ for my arrest. None of this, of course, was in the legal sense. I wasn't given an opportunity to determine indigency or anything to that effect. And, you know, I'm just curious as to what I can do to, you know, put them back in, on their heels. And
well, look, if you're in court, and you're not on the offense and they're on the defense, if they're on the defense and you're on the offense, you're winning, okay? You're moving along, you're chugging along, and you reasonably know what you're doing. You know, that should suggest that you reasonably know what you're doing. But if you are constantly on the defense and they are constantly on the offense, you got a problem. You're losing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like, you know, you don't have the knowledge to really do it. The only thing we could suggest to you is to go through the process of joining your case with us. You know, what we do is we do an amicus curiae, which is a paper coming particularly from the grand jury on your behalf, and then we challenge the jurisdiction, which they must now prove, and
yep.
And if they ignore that or whatever the case may be, they got 30 days to respond. After that, then we join them to the case, we move them into our case, and then it becomes under a federal case decision. And the only thing a federal courts really could do on that end is really deal with the constitutional issue, and the constitutional issue is that they don't have the jurisdiction. Now they have to find another venue, another way to deal. Look at, why don't we just get into real courts? Why do we have to play around with all these courts? You know, let's get real courts, because then you can get justice for both sides. You know, this is a family matter. Are your children taken away from you, or your wife has them, or what?
First, we were never married. About 5 years ago, it was just one accusation after another.
Right. Well, we don't want to get into those details. The bottom line is this. The court doesn't have jurisdiction, and they need to take you to a venue where justice can be had. And, you know, of course, we have to take care of our children. If that's our children, we have to do what we have to do. But these courts are so unfair, and they're just really a weapon is what they are. And this whole system with family courts has to be totally changed throughout the whole nation. It doesn't work. It clearly just does not work. It's destructive to the family. How can you get lawyers to decide what a family is going to do? How do you get a bunch of lawyers to decide what's right for the child and the psychological, the physical, and the spiritual health of that child? Most lawyers, you know, they're godless. I mean, they prove that by their actions, where they act in court. Most of them are godless.
We're going to
change the whole process, but you have to do something. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, you got to do something. I mean, we can try to help you, or you can continue to fight. I mean, but again, it doesn't sound like you have enough knowledge to be able to win, and very few people do, because the whole thing's top secret. There's so many mysteries. It took me years to figure out some of these mysteries.
Well, today I actually was working with one of the gentlemen there and filed the paperwork for the joinder. I've also prepared my jurisdictional challenge, which will be going out tomorrow, and then begin the process of defaulting.
Hold it. You prepared it or we prepared it?
Well, I used the documents that you have online, and I prepared it
No. If you're going to try to join your case to ours, then we have to do the paperwork. We'll do that for you.
Okay.
Don't you do
perfect.
It. It's got to come from us because we got more clout, we put a little more fear. They don't know who we are. They scratch their head. They make a few phone calls maybe. But I think now if they make a few phone calls, they're going to find a little bit of hesitation on the other side now and not so easily move. Don't worry about it. We're going to throw this case out. You know, I think a lot of things are going to change. The environment, the political environment is an important part of what we're doing, what's going on right now in Washington. And so we're at a point where, you know, the leverage is changing, and we're starting to get the leverage. And I think that's going to be clearer and clearer as this month, as we go through the month of August.
Who should I reach out to have you guys work on it with me?
Just talk to, well, did you said you talked with Jim, or Jim's the guy who's handling it. He's probably the guy you talked to. You sent something to intake at National Liberty Alliance?
Yes, sir, yep.
Okay, then Jim's the one that's handling it. If you follow the instructions that Jim gives you, you know, and follow it to the letter, don't get ahead of us. Just move along. Make sure everything's done properly as we go forward. You can get it within a week. We can have the paper into the courts. But it's
wonderful.
Up to you, you know, following up on your case, getting the information, and not trying to get ahead of the game.
I can definitely, I would be very appreciative to see to have you guys, you know, help me along the process.
All right, we're going to move to our next caller, and we'll see how things go over the next few weeks. You know.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, our next caller. Let's see, no name up there. Maybe we can get the name for this next person. It's a 928 area code. What's your first name and your state?
Hi, my name's Tamara. I'm from Arizona.
Okay. Go right ahead, Tamara.
I actually have five different cases that are all stemming from one unlawful arrest. And we've picked the CPS part of it to be the first joinder. I'm just wondering at what point of the process with
did,
this
did everything else stem from the CPS?
No, everything stemmed from the unlawful arrest.
And how long ago was that? And is there a special, you know, are you still going to court for that? Or what's the deal?
That was on June 23rd when they arrested me and they forced me to appear and forced me to sign a plea agreement. I was under handcuffs.
Okay, so that's one case. What else happened? That do you get another number or something, another case number? What's
okay,
the next
well, after
thing that
they
happened?
Arrested me, they charged me with CPS child neglect, which Jim's
okay,
already started.
Okay, but that's all still under the same court number, isn't it? Or is it another court now, or the CPS court?
It was a totally different court. It was the
okay,
first
so
court.
The family court. Okay, well, hold on. Let me try to move through this quickly just to try to get an understanding, and then I'll give you a thought on it. Okay, so you have a situation where you were arrested. Was that a town court?
It was a town justice court, yes.
Okay, so town court. Then they hit you up with something with the CPS, and now you have a family court issue, correct? You got two courts so far. What
yes,
are the courts?
Yes, and they made me appear for everything. And then the next thing was while I was in jail, another police officer charged me with driving with a revoked plate and no license, which was untrue.
Okay, so now you have another town court with a different number.
Yes, and then my ex-husband's wife of 6 months before we were divorced came to the same judge who married them and requested a charge of harassment against me, which I did not do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, well, look, at the important ones here are the one that's arrested and the one with the CPS. And let me think. You're going to have to do two papers for you. I mean, you know, we asked for a donation, but we don't need – we're not going to hit you up for two donations. You know, just give a basic donation and whatever you can. We ask for $100 or more, but sometimes people can only afford 50 or something, you know, or whatever, or $10, you know, just something to help with the costs. But if you get your stuff to Jim, those first two cases is the key ones that we really should be focusing in on.
Yeah,
and,
so I should wait until he has the CPS joinder and all of that before I start the other one?
No, you could do two of them at the same time, okay? But here's the thing. The one where they you said was untrue, okay? Maybe you can just go to that traffic court and produce the papers and show them it's untrue. Is that something going to be that simple?
Yeah, well, I demanded that the accuser be in the courts, and so they adjourned it.
Yep, but the thing is that they got you for what, an unregistered vehicle?
Well, my vehicle is... The second charge or when I was originally arrested?
No. You said that first we went through the fact that you were arrested. Then we went to the CPS court. Then there was another court where they said something with plates or something.
Yeah. They accused me of driving with a revoked license plate, which they did that on June 26th, but my registration was good until June 30th.
I don't understand that. Okay, so where did they get the 26th date?
The officer made an affidavit of complaint without executing it under notary on June 26th after I was arrested on June 23rd. He states that I had come into the police station on May 21st, which I didn't. I was in California then. I came in on June 21st, but not on May 21st. And then
all right, well, look, let's do this. Work on the first two cases and then, try to go down and see if you can't straighten it out. Because some of these things like that you can straighten out, just producing paperwork. And if you can't, then you can do another one.
I got a notice today from the district attorney stating they're prepared to go to trial.
For which case?
For the one about the tickets of revoked license and all that.
All right, well, again, get your paperwork in. That's all I can tell you, and move from there. Again, you don't have the experience to really try to do it yourself because they're going to railroad you, and if people don't know how to push things along and force it to go to move to the next step, it's just they're going to just take total control. And that's how they know that you don't know what you're doing, when they see that the case still sits there and it keeps going and going and they realize, well, okay, they don't know what to do. They don't know what's really happening. They don't know the law. And they just make it up as they go at that point. Well, I think they do that right off the bat anyway, or more often than not. Anyway, get your stuff to Jim, and we'll take it from there. Okay?
Okay, so should I try to separate them, just keep them all separate?
Well, yeah, you can't write a paper and put three court case numbers on and file in all three courts. Each one has to be individual.
Yeah, they have.
So
to
the two
be
important
individual.
Ones is where you want to start, I think.
Okay. All right. So I'll talk to Jim and tell him that I should also do the first, the reason why I was thrown in jail for unlawfully, for resisting arrest. So that case has to be taken care of in conjunction with the CPS because they're both connected to each other.
Right. Well, that's why I said those two should probably be the first.
All right. Okay. So I should do the joinder form, the first part of it, and then file a joinder with this
for
the second
part. Jim will walk you through it. Just tell him you need to do the two cases so they'll be done separately.
Okay.
And
all right.
See how you can work out the other one or two, and then if you can't, you can do something on that too.
Yeah. If I understand how to keep the case moving, should I go ahead and follow the plan for the other case where I've been charged with harassment? Should I continue with that by getting a challenge of jurisdiction and doing all those
things? Well, again, you don't know what to do after that because the judge is going to slap his hammer and say, I got jurisdiction, let's move on. And what are you going to do then?
Do a default?
Well, you don't know.
If they don't answer within 30 days, do a default on
them? No. He's not even going to wait 30 days. He's not even going to have a hearing. You're going to go to court. He's going to, if he looks at your paper, he may even ignore it. And he looks at the paper and he's going to say, yeah, I saw your paper and I decided I have jurisdiction, so let's move on. Stop wasting the court's time. And they're just going
to
move on.
I would object to that because he's not allowed to make those
objection notice. Your objection notice. Let's move on. That's what he's going to say. Listen, you have to know what to do next. You have to produce. You know, you have to portray yourself in the court in such a fashion that, to begin with, you're saying bare minimum. You're responding to the things that the judge is saying, and you're bringing up, an opposition. Making a case against whatever he has to say. You put the papers out. For instance, the papers in the court, and he says, "Well, okay, I decide I'm going to have jurisdiction. I object, Your Honor, because you have to remove yourself for bias." The law says that a case has to be heard. Once a case is challenged, it must be heard. And that means you got to rule on both sides. You already have my paper, and you don't have a paper from the other side. And if you want to rule on just my paper, then you know what? You got to rule for me, because you can't decide anything outside and beyond what's before the court at this point. And I made a good case to show you, you need to shut it down. And nobody has rebutted that. And therefore, since you have moved to decide this case before hearing it, right there's a violation, you're proven bias, and you need to recuse yourself. And then when he turns around and says, "Well, look, that's nice, but we're going to move along, enough, let's go forward." And then he'll move over to the other side or maybe and see what's going to go. What are you going to do then? You see, you got to know what you're doing as you go through. And this happens through, the school of hard knocks. I've been through all this where you're stuck in the court. You say, "Oh, goodness, what do I do now?" And then you move to the next step, and you learn the next step. And learn. It took me a long time to figure out all these mysteries. There's nothing but mysteries, okay?
Right.
A long time took me to figure it out. And so now you gotta do something. You got to move it to federal court for cause. You need to know how to do that. You need to file the papers correctly. You need to make the right points. You're focusing in on cause. A cause is a constitutional cause. The fact that one of your unalienable rights was injured, you were injured by, they violated your unalienable right, that's a cause. And when you go into the federal court, if the judge doesn't see that you don't know what you're doing and doesn't know where to go the next step, and they're going to take advantage of you too because he wants it out of his court, and he's going to throw it out of his court. Again, what's the next step? So if you don't have those experiences, you can't really do this. I know there are people teaching people, saying, "Go in and say this, go write this paper, file this paper." It's not that easy. It doesn't work. They're just, I don't know what they're doing, but it just doesn't work that way. I mean, if you have a lot of experience as a pro se, I can give you all kinds of stuff, and then you work your strategies. But you got to have experience.
Yeah, and
so anyway,
I think that's the problem for me is that I live in Arizona, yeah, and this case is in New York.
So what does that mean?
Well, do I have to be present, or can I be there by telephone?
No, not at all. Not at all. No. Look, we're doing this because there's a conspiracy, and we're making that point. Okay, this is not just your case in one place. There's thousands and thousands of people that have a similar case to yours, and they're moving it on, okay? And so we're bringing this whole thing together. It's in a federal court. Doesn't matter. No, it is true. It should be in your own federal district court. But we're moving it and connecting it to ours because we're making a point. We're using it as evidence, and we're opening up a court of record. And we have a strategy with that. So, no, you don't have to be there. The papers, look, the only thing that is the interest of a federal court is, do they have jurisdiction? And it's a very simple thing. It's hands down, doesn't even need to be discussed, okay? Town courts, village courts, city courts have no jurisdiction, okay? Mm-hmm. If they bring up any statute, any code, any regulation, they just prove to us they don't have jurisdiction, okay? Mm-hmm. Because you have a sovereign immunity from all legislative law. That's what's called liberty. That's why our founding fathers built our nation on that point, for government to leave and stay out of your life and leave you alone, okay? Government does not, when we the people ordained and established this Constitution for the government we're creating, for the people running our government, for the United States of America, when we did that, we're above the Constitution. They're chained down below the Constitution. And we gave them legislative powers on the federal level, and that extends right on through. And the whole concept of liberty and freedom goes right down into the town, okay? But it goes down into the state laws and whatever the county uses, which generally is state laws. But you know, the whole thing is really getting back down to the fact that they're statutory. It's called equity. And if they're in an equity court, okay, they cannot violate your unalienable rights. It's not due process. Equity courts are not due process. Only courts of law is due process. You have to understand that. When you understand that concept, there is your argument. And that's how. But this is what the people forgot. I mean, the people, all the people forgot it. They forgot what we are and who we are and where we come from. They forgot it. So anyway, if you want to help.
If I don't have anything filed by the 12th of August, is that where the cutoff line is for everyone?
No. This case is going to go for a while. Even when we're winning and things are moving, we get to that point, we'll still be pulling cases in. These people have got to stop their abuse. And that's what this case is all about, the abuse of the courts.
Yep.
Okay? So, no, we're taking papers long after that.
All right. Thank you for your help.
And once we get to the end of it, that would mean we're setting up administrations in the counties, and once we're doing that, then you could just go down to your county and talk to the people who are administrating to the juries, and you can get access to the grand jury and so on, because the grand jury can protect you.
How long do you think that'll be before we actually have that?
Well, we've been fighting this very issue and planning since the end of 2013, and now we're coming to the climax. We're coming to the pinnacle, the point where everything we've been working to do, this is what we're doing now. We're there. Okay, how long is it going to take after that? I don't know. It depends on how deep the deep state is. Mm-hmm. You know? So, it's got to be done. What Trump is doing in Washington, it has to be done before this year is out. And the reason being, because next year is an election year. Mm-hmm. And so this has got to be done before that. Court cases need to be moving. And Q has already said August is going to be a very hot month. So with that, all right, we got a few other people and we're running close to the end, so we're going to move on and just get a hold of Jim.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, didn't I say that, Terry? August is a hot month? I think that's what I said. Q said August is a hot month. Okay, thanks. Next individual, Audrey, it looks like, from New York. 58 Buys, New York. I see the name Audrey there. 298, Audrey from New York. One more time, Audrey from New York. You've been unmuted. Hello, Audrey. Okay, we're going to move to our next caller. We'll go to Dan from the Carolinas. Dan, you got the mic.
Yeah. Okay. Again, excellent conference tonight. It's that every night that everybody can be expecting to be highly informed. Just wanted to check with you guys the upcoming documents that you want all of us to send out. Those will be, I presume they'll be time stamped in the court with all the applications and motions and everything, and then you'll either put this in a PDX format for us to get copies of to then send them out and to the various officials. And if I remember correctly, you can correct me on this for just a second. In some cases, there will be certain officers or alleged officers of whatever states like North Carolina, South Carolina, or what have you, that you will want us to try to at least be top priority to do the mailings?
Well, yeah. You look at all of the defendants, we will do direct the court filing and certain individuals, of course, the president under information, the attorney general for action and also as an information. But we'll also file completely with both houses and the judiciary. I mean, the United States Supreme Court, and also two filings, one in a statutory under a statutory number, and one under common law. So all of that, you know, I'm going to handle. But we need to get it out to 94 federal district courts.
Okay.
So if you could do one or two or three, we'll give you the addresses for those things, and then you put the you know, the return address that we give you. And each paper is going to cost you $7.49 to mail in a priority mail flat rate envelope. We will give you a picture of what that looks like, and you can ask at the it's $7.49. Whatever you can fit in that envelope, no matter how heavy it is, they'll send it for $7.49. You'll get a receipt.
Will that be grain? Pardon me. Will that be grain tag or red tag, possibly? Certified, return receipt requested.
No, none of that. No. When you get a priority, it's a priority mail, okay? There's a flat rate envelope. It's right there. It's a cardboard envelope. They have it there. You can ask for it. The name is, and we'll give you the name writing, priority mail, flat rate envelope, okay? And with that, that is automatically tracked. So you'll get a receipt. And when you get the receipt, You scan it or take a picture of it, and you get that to Jim when you get that receipt. As a matter of fact, let me think about that. No, that you just mail it to probably we'll do mail at nationallibertyalliance.org. You mail it to mail, and then I'll pick up on that, and I'll pull it over, and we'll put it into the record so that we got proof and tracking by tracking. So, but it only costs $7.49, and it'll take 450 pages, and you could buy a ream of paper for $7 and change also. So $8, you know, you buy a ream of paper, and you can do up to 10 in that, or 9 or 10 out of that. But whatever you can do. So it should cost, if someone did 10 of them, it would cost them maybe about $80.
If I remember correctly, let me interject this for just a second. I know we got probably some other people there, and it's getting late. If I remember, you were not in any kind of opposition where, in, for example, two counties predominantly, Brunswick County in North Carolina and then New Hanover County, they join one another. But maybe the sheriffs, and if not, do you think that you're going to be sending in at least like you did, possibly did before, to the clerk of court and possibly maybe the head judges? I wouldn't be in opposition to pay for sending it to the head judges in both of those counties, and also I'd be glad to send it right on to the attorney general and also the governor of both states, North Carolina and South Carolina.
All right. Well, let Jan know that, and he'll put you on a list, and we'll pump out the addresses that you'll need to send to, and we'll give you. And we even took a picture of the envelope, so you can, when you go in the post office, you'll be able to see it. You know, it's a PDF copy of the envelope that we scanned in, and but again, it's just called priority mail flat rate envelope, and that's all it is.
Let me ask you real quick. I got you. Very good. You're so informative. Let me quickly ask you, do you guys have, or is it already registered at some point where you've uploaded it into the nationallibertyalliance.org website? And that is a basic, just blank, but a basic format for an affidavit.
Yeah, look, what we're going to do is when we're ready, okay, and we know what day we're going to file it on, we will post it on a private place where anybody that's mailing it out for us, okay, will have access to that page, and you'll be able to download it. And when you download it, just print it off exactly how it is and put it into the envelope. You know, you don't have to do nothing else. The signature, everything will be on it. The seal will be on it. It will be in order. And, you know, if you can, you put a staple on it. If it's pretty thick, you might want to put a big clip on it or whatever. Pages are numbered anyway. And you stick it in that folder and mail it out. Very simple.
I apologize. And, let me differentiate
Let me just finish up on that point, though. We will post them as early as possible and will notify everyone as early as possible so that they have time to download it, print it, get it all ready, and it'll be. And then when we want you to mail it, then we'll contact you again and say, okay, mail it on this date. Okay, so you can pre-print it and have it all ready to rock and roll, and just waiting for us to tell you, okay, mail it on Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever day we say, and then on that day, you know, you go and mail it.
Well, I don't want to sound facetious here, but it is under a presumption. I'm asking this for making a comment. If you send to us where you have filed the documents, it looks like to me it would have, I don't know what you, how you want to do it, but for us to send it on would be a courtesy copy of where it's stamped in and then filed in federal court. Is that what we're going to receive?
Well, once you mail it, you'll get a receipt, and the receipt is the proof of service.
You're not quite understanding what I'm asking. I understand all the process. I've done a lot of that. Listen, for the benefit of a lot of people, the document that you're going to send us for us designated to such and such and whoever, you will be explicit on that. But what I'm asking is this document going to be time-stamped in to some court, federal court, showing a receipt from that clerk? It's not. Okay.
Listen, we're going to file the original. So we filed the original, okay?
Sure.
You're just serving on someone else. And it's, look, we in the paper, we talk about respondents and defendants,
okay?
The defendants have to literally respond, okay? They got to literally respond. The respondents, we make it clear that respondents, we just want them to respond with obedience to the law, okay?
Right.
And it's really putting them on notice that we're here, we're coming, and we're ending all of this lawlessness. That's where we're putting them on notice of,
okay?
But I got to move on because I got one other caller.
Let me ask you real quickly, if I may, have you yet put on, or Mr. Brent, either a copy of what would be a common law trust? And again, I would like to receive a copy of a standard format for an affidavit. I prepared an affidavit, but I've been waiting for some time and kept checking the website. I don't see a common law trust, and I know you're busy, so...
Well,
when you
say a common law trust, what do you mean when you're saying
land
that?
Trust,
sort of...
land trust. You remember we talked about that several months ago?
Okay. I believe we did post that up there. Let me think if we did.
No, listen, don't type a lot of it. Go on to your next person, and I'll try to get it with Jan tomorrow, okay?
Okay. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, and I'll check to see if we got it up there. I'm pretty sure I did post something up there for that.
If you and Brent can get a copy, just a standard format of what would be an affidavit, I've got one ready, and it's very comprehensive. Okay, it's about the estate. So let me veer here because I feel guilty here. I mean, there's other people that's getting late.
Right, you've got one other person, so I want to get them in. So, okay, yeah, I'll get it up there if it's not there, and you can hit me up on it next week maybe again, but I'm pretty sure I put it up. I'll let you know then, okay?
Yeah, I'd really like to talk with Brent, but I never have been able to catch him other than on this conference. But anyway, thanks, sir.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll take our last caller. It is Pennsylvania. What's your first name?
This is Drew in Pennsylvania, Luzerne County.
Drew? Okay. How you doing, Drew?
Good job. I talked to you before about the situation where my wife left and the PFA and the divorce and everything filed. I got to go for the PFA hearing tomorrow. They continued it for 3 months because I didn't agree to it the first time. So I have to go tomorrow. And, I did talk to a lawyer, which I know you don't do. But he's not available tomorrow anyway, so he told me to get a short continuance because I continued the custody here until August 30th.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of up in the air with this, like, what to do. I would like to take care of it myself, but I'm just not sure I'm ready for that right now. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, she could
well,
put it on.
Well, remember, you know, what we anything that we do, we're looking to get a throne out of the court. That's what we're looking to do. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't be back into the court. But what we want is we want a just court. And until they can open a just court, then we should be denying them. Okay?
Right.
And that's the whole point to this whole thing. Okay?
Well,
you know,
I
innocent, guilty of anything, especially in the criminal side of things. But, look, we need a just court. Yeah, I have never seen a just court that deals with, you know, with children and families. I have not seen one at all. They're just nothing but a money-making machine.
Yeah, they're corrupt and they're biased. You know, she was biased against me when she said that what my wife was, you know, my wife's the step-grandmother of the child. You know, we raised her since she was, born 13 years. We're married 18 years.
Right.
Like I said, you know, I checked in everything, and my ex is involved in every aspect of this of 35 years ago. You know, I want the courts to be aware that this is harassment by, you know, by abuse of courts. You know, that's what it is. It's harassment by law, you know.
Look, all they're doing is chasing the money, okay? You said you've been in there 5 years, okay? You're going to be there until your child is 21,
I wasn't in there 5 years. This just happened. This just happened in April. She left.
Oh, okay. I was thinking that you were for five. Okay.
No, my ex is behind
Some people are going to these courts for 5 years. Okay.
Well, I know that. I've been dealing with these courts since I was 16 years old. That's when I started paying support for my first daughter of my ex of 35. That's the one who's behind all this. And I fought custody. I'd done 3 evaluations already. I did the whole thing with. I've been going through this, but you know what? They violate my right. I told you it was legal adoption. There's a fraudulent adoption. The paperwork is marked with my daughter's name, which is a fraudulent name. You know, that's not pertaining to this hearing here, though, but it's coming.
Well, we don't want to get into too many of those details, but what you do deserve and everyone deserves is a court that is going to bring justice. And there's things on both sides, and to deal with the case quickly and move on. Let people get on with their lives. Stop abusing, because they abuse our children. They separate them. They take fathers away from children all day long. This is kind of their job.
What they're enabling right now is my wife and my granddaughter are victims of my ex now. They're enabling this emotional and mental abuse that's going on. They're being twisted up and manipulated and coerced to do all this stuff. And this is really what's going on. My wife, she has MS, and she has some cognitive problems and stuff. She's taking advantage of that. And the court's enabling this, you know, and they need to be aware of what's going on. This is harassment and stalking and everything else that I've been dealing with here.
Hey, well, again, what we're moving for and we want to do and we want to get is a court of justice. And courts of justice are a good thing, you know, everybody, because they will be just, and you'll agree. Yeah, that's just.
The justice,
you know?
Mercy, recourse, and remedy. That's what I want, exactly.
Yeah, that's what you'll get. And but that's not what they're giving us. And it's really a cash machine.
What do I do tomorrow?
Family court is RICO on steroids. It's a cash machine. Town courts, city courts, village courts, they're cash machines. It's RICO on steroids. That's all it is. But
I would like to file federal court,
all of them, the same thing.
Well, let's file a RICO claim because I have all these people implicated. I have the court administrator who did the fraudulent adoption when he was attorney. How many years ago? 30-something years ago. He's the guy. I know he did it. I had her ex-husband tell me he did it. I have him on that. I have all this other stuff. You know, I get the child support I was paying for years. They're trying to lock me up. They're implicated in this because they were paying support on a fraudulent, make me pay on a fraudulent adoption.
All right. Well, we don't want to get into the details of the case, though. I mean, again, you know, we want to deal with just moving to justice courts. Here's the bottom line. All these courts do not have jurisdiction, number one, and that's how you beat them. And the other thing is they ultimately are bringing you and hold on a minute. They are hijacking you or what's the other word? Well, they're hijacking you. Kidnapping you is the other word. And the federal code uses kidnapping. But they're hijacking you or kidnapping you into jurisdictions unknown. and therefore you're not getting your due process. So they don't have the jurisdiction, you're not getting due process, and you've been hijacked, the jurisdiction's unknown. Those are the 3 points. That's how you win the battle. And
well,
and if you want to get back into the courts to get justice, well, then you got to get into a justice court. It's going to be a while before that happens. But
so
anyway,
jurisdiction,
to the end.
Is it subject matter jurisdiction they have and they don't have personal jurisdiction, or what is it?
They don't even have subject matter jurisdiction. They have
really?
No jurisdiction.
Yeah, because you refer that to the courts and they say, oh, well, statute this and this, and that's what they say. You know, that's how we have jurisdiction.
Yeah, look, on the lower courts, okay, when you get into the village courts and the town courts, these guys, they're not even lawyers. They're not even real judges. They're just people. They get elected to these positions,
sure.
And then they go to judge school for a week or two, and they come out. And really, who's really running that court really is the lawyer that's in the court acting as a prosecutor. He's telling the judge what to do, and that's how the judge learns. And
I wanted to file FOIA requests to see their standing. I want to see their bonds and their licenses and their...
They're not going to do nothing. It doesn't mean anything. You're not going to get anywhere with that. You challenge jurisdiction, move it on. Okay, and you got to move it yourself.
Tell them I want to challenge jurisdiction. That's it, because I mean they can't do anything once you do that, right? I mean, do I have to write it out, or can I just tell them?
The law says that the court cannot go. Doesn't mean that they're going to break the law. Now, remember this: there's nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action. You got a guy with a hammer. He's got all kinds of power, and he tells the cops to do this, and they go do that, and they put people in jail, and they do all kinds of stupid things, and it's all ignorance. Everything is ignorance.
I don't worry, they don't even know the case. They don't even know what's going on. It's all one-sided.
Never know. Never know what they're going to do. You just don't know.
I'm not going to keep you on, Joe, but here's the thing. My focus tomorrow, I really would like to buy some time with this. Should I ask for the continuance so I can get more prepared?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, if they don't give it to me.
Tell them you talked with counsel. You said you talked with a lawyer, right?
Yeah.
And you said to get a continuance. So just tell them, hey, you talked with a lawyer and told me to get a continuance. Here I am. How long do you need? Well, I need 30, 40, 50 days. Whatever you can get.
Well, they said short. He said short, like a week or two. He said make it short so that we don't go past the custody hearing. You have to take care of this protection from abuse before the custody hearing, because they don't have nothing on it, you know?
So you're going to use the lawyer to go through the process. I mean, sometimes you can do that, but, you know, it's...
Well, I really don't want to, but I'm going to go in there to ask for continuance. But if they don't give me the continuance, should I challenge the jurisdiction then?
Well, it doesn't mean anything to them there. You never want to challenge while you're in the court. You want to challenge on paper and get it into the court and file it. Okay, and then you can always refer to the paper. If you challenge the jurisdiction, you know, he's going to move through it quickly and say, I got jurisdiction, enough of your nonsense, let's move on.
But what I'm concerned about is when I'm in court, if she gives me a 3-year protection from abuse, I can't do anything. I can't try to reconcile my family. I can't try to get involved because I already filed stuff and I couldn't send it. I couldn't mail out the copies because you'll be violent PFA, third-party thing. So I can't even mail out copies. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I understand. I remember you talking about this. But again, these are details. Again, you only win the case on the facts. And the fact that, the question is, do you want to win or do you want to fight, okay? If you want to fight, then you go through all these little things and you fight every issue. You want to win, shut them down with jurisdiction.
So here's the thing. If I go in there tomorrow and she gives me a 3-year PFA, okay, I walk out, I got a 3-year PFA. I mean, then do I file the challenge under jurisdiction?
It's up to you what you want to do. I can't tell you what you want to do, but I don't understand what that means. What you're saying, you don't have to go back to court no more?
I'm trying to avoid this your PFA, and if I go there tomorrow and I ask for a continuance to me and you're telling me not to challenge jurisdiction, but the fact is she could end up putting that your PFA on me, and then what do I do? Can I challenge jurisdiction after the fact, but I'm still
you
stuck
could challenge jurisdiction. You could challenge jurisdiction even if it was a criminal case and you went to jail, you served your time, and you came out, and then you discovered you could challenge jurisdiction then. You could challenge jurisdiction at any time.
I understand that, but what I'm saying is she puts your PFA on me, it's in effect, and I could challenge jurisdiction. It's a little too late because she already has an effect, right? Or would it negate it? It wouldn't do anything to it, right?
Well, again, I'm not understanding what you're saying. You
Say this again.
What I said was the outcome of tomorrow. If I go in there and ask for continuance, they say, no, we already, you know, we've been here 3 months, whatever, we're going to do this, and, you know, go forth with this hearing or whatever. And then I come out of it with a 3-year PFA. Now my hands are tied for 3 years. I can't try to take care of things in my family or file anything on them. So let's say,
of course, you can file jurisdiction. Once jurisdiction and challenges must be heard, and if you're successful, and you should be successful if you learn about it and do it the right way, then everything that court done is null and void. It has no power, no authority, nothing. Even if that's the if they had a an order of protection on you, even that, okay, it's all irrelevant. It doesn't have no more power. Go get a real court to do it in.
So if they file, if they do the worst case scenario, they do get a 3-year protection order of protection on me tomorrow, and I file that.
You can have it thrown out once you win on the jurisdiction.
Right, but I mean, how long would I have?
Jurisdiction squashes everything. It's all gone. Everything.
Right. How long is it going to take me to go to court for the jurisdiction challenge?
30 days.
That's it?
But that doesn't mean you're going to be successful at it, because they may not respond, and then you're going to move it into federal court for cause,
right,
because they denied your due process.
Oh, I get you. Okay. All right.
And
well,
now you can not only be returned back to your original state before this whole nonsense started, but now you're being injured and then you can get something for injury.
For a tort claim.
But anyway, we've run over our time. So.
All right, thank you.
Okay?
All right, I appreciate you. All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, I guess we're going to close down. Good night, everyone. Lord willing, we'll be back next Monday, and our plan is to file next week. That's sort of our plan. It could change a little bit, but that's our focus. And anybody that can help by getting some papers out for us, get a hold of Jan. You can get him by email, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org, or you can go up to the directory and get more information on Jan, give him a call or whatever. But we do need help sending out more papers. We want to get it out to as many people as we can. All right. Godspeed, everyone. See you next Monday, Lord willing. Good night.